This is Guns and Butter.
There's something happening, yeah. Yeah, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
And I've seen German politicians and former judges rail at this and say, what have you done to our country? You have sworn an oath of office to protect and defend Germany and to promote the general welfare, and you're not doing it by letting in a wave of people who speak no known language, who have no ties to the area of culture, of religion, of history, or anything else, and suddenly you lose track of them all. How does this happen? It's just astonishing.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, J. Michael Springman. Today's show, Migration as Asymmetric Warfare. Michael Springman is a former diplomat in the State Department's Foreign Service, with postings to Germany, India, Saudi Arabia, and the Bureau of Intelligence and Research in Washington, D.C. He was chief of the non-immigrant visa section in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, from 1987 to 1989. His latest book is Goodbye Europe, Hello Chaos, Merkel's Migrant Bomb, in which he provides an in-depth analysis of the migrant flood, its causes, and what it means for Europe. Building on arguments put forward in his classic work, Visas for Al-Qaeda, CIA Handouts That Rocked the World, An Insider's View, he reveals how U.S. foreign policy created the crisis. As an ex-State Department official and attorney, his insider knowledge of U.S. policy reveals a world where immigrants become weapons, nationalism is condemned, and civil liberties hang in the balance. Michael Springman, welcome. It's great to have you back on again.
Well, it's good to be here, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak to your listeners.
In your new book about the migrant crisis facing Europe, Goodbye Europe, Hello Chaos, Merkel's Migrant Bomb, you pay special attention to Germany and German Chancellor Angela Merkel. I knew that Angela Merkel is the daughter of a Lutheran minister and that she's from East Germany, the former German Democratic Republic. You have some more information on her, but not a whole lot. What do we know about Merkel and her background?
Well, she's very good at concealing her background. She was born in Hamburg and taken as an infant to the East, where she and her family got special treatment because her father created a branch of the Lutheran Church that was subservient, in a sense, to the East German government and worked, in fact, to help prop up that government. And Merkel grew up there, spent 35 years in the East, joined the Free German Youth. Because her father was subservient to the government, she got to study at prestigious schools, went on to get a PhD in physics, and this was at a time when the clergy's children were routinely refused advantages. They had cars, they had trips abroad, that kind of thing. And in my research for the book, I found that Jonathan Powell, who had been chief of staff to former British Prime Minister Tony Blair, he had described Merkel as a ruthless, vicious politician. And of course, Mama Merkel portrays herself as mother of the nation, and she's has her arms open to all the children of the world who want to come to Germany. And from what I can see, that's not the case. I'll give you a further example. She was very close to Lothar de Maizière, the last non-communist head of the East Germany, the German Democratic Republic, and she knew all his background. She became a protege of Helmut Kohl, the West German chancellor at the time and head of the Christian Democratic Union, the large center-right party. And it seems somehow, in some way, Kohl's background in slush funds, illegal financial transactions, black money, you name it, somehow became public. And Kohl was removed as head of the party. The guy next in line to be head of the party had been Lothar de Maizière, but somehow, some way, the information got out to the press that this guy had a background in the Stasi, the state security service that spied on everybody and everyone in East Germany. And the only person close to either of them who knew all their dark secrets was Angela Merkel. So I think that she has a public persona and a private persona. And there's a lot of stuff in the private persona that I think we need to know and don't.
So what is your assessment of Angela Merkel? Is there evidence, or have you found any evidence, that she was involved with the East German Stasi?
Well, they claimed that she had resisted the one attempt to recruit her. But then she'd also been involved in agitation and propaganda when she was part of the East German Youth. And the funny thing is, other people whom she had known in the East and were part of the Stasi, she's brought into her government. There was an Annetta Kahana, whose code name was Victoria with the Stasi. She now has indirect control of Germany's war on hate speech. And Merkel's justice minister had recruited her and the organization that she had founded, something called Network Against Nazis, to define and control controversial language. Hmm. And the Adara press apparently came out at one point and accused her of being a Stasi informant, with her being an unofficial associate with the security service. And, you know, Merkel's always maintained that she's only been involved in cultural affairs with the Free German Youth and was not involved with the bad boys at all. So, you know, people say things, but whether or not they can prove it, I don't know. There's one guy who apparently had been involved in writing a news article with Der Spiegel. He had claimed that she had also been a secretary for agitation and propaganda when she was in the Free German Youth. So, you know, it's there's all speculation. There's people talking. But she never admits her closeness to the old East German system. And at one point had is supposed to have said, if we reform East Germany, it won't be in terms of the West German Federal Republic. So I guess the imprint, I guess, of the old East German ways are still in her mindset, and she's going to command and control from the top instead of doing a conciliatory democracy like her predecessors had done.
According to your book, Germany's Federal Office for Migration and Refugees tweeted on August 25th, 2015, quote, "We are no longer enforcing the Dublin procedures for Syrian citizens." What are the Dublin procedures, and have they been reinstituted?
Well, the Dublin procedure was the idea that you get to the European Union, and whichever country in the European Union you get to first, you apply for asylum or refugee status there, not wandering from country to country and trying to find the best deal, kind of like Goldilocks and the Three Bears. And as far as I know, they've been trying to reinstitute the Dublin procedures, but they've not been successful at it.
Now, I also read in your book that in 2015, Austria and Germany abolished the law temporarily, and migrants didn't need to register. Is that true?
Yes. I was told by the Austrian embassy, I had sent them an email and said, well, you know, can you give me some figures on the wave of migrants through Austria? And I was told, no, we can't, because there was such a flood that we couldn't keep track of them. They just poured across the border and kept going.
The surge of immigrants into Germany began in early spring of 2015. Mm-hmm. Is there evidence of a clandestine human smuggling operation planned, funded, and coordinated by foreign intelligence agencies?
Well, I've not found anything that says, yes, indeed, these guys did this there and then. But from my readings and from my research and from what other people have written, I think that this was planned and this was carried out. At one point, for example, I read that the American government was funding boats for migrants, and the French government was helping distribute them to refugees in Turkey so they could go across the Ionian Sea to Greece. I've seen things that talked about how there were organizations in Syria and other countries that were creating nearly perfect counterfeit Iraqi and Syrian passports. And I'm not sure how you can do this in a country where it's all you can do to get enough to eat and you don't even have time to pray. I've also read that the security services who were supposedly watching these people somehow lost track of them. And I'm not quite sure how, if it's your job to follow someone, you can suddenly lose him all of a sudden. That's been the big issue. There have been organizations, for example, like Cisco Systems, that somehow out of the goodness of their heart contributed hundreds of thousands of dollars to non-governmental organizations like Mercy Corps and NetHope to handle refugees and to set up Wi-Fi arrangements in the Balkans on the migrant routes to bring people north and west. People have their expensive cell phones and somehow connect to the internet and guide them to where they want to go. They can get them their the price of a smuggler in Greece or what it costs to go from Turkey to Germany. So it's very, very peculiar. And we've got people like George Soros, who's always the big bad boogeyman. He is supposedly coming up with apps for iPhones to help guide these people. His Central European University in Budapest, which is being targeted by the Hungarian government for its strange extracurricular activities, they've recruited interpreters to help people move and get themselves asylum in Europe. So there's enough there that it's, you know, you're 50 to 75% certain that the intelligence services are doing it, but you can figure out exactly who is doing it and name names and times of day and things like this.
Yes, I'd like to go into some of that in a little bit more detail. But first, how would you characterize the majority of the migrants into Europe? Are they families? And if not, who are they?
They're mostly young, single men. In Sweden, I think it was something like 70% of the applicants for asylum or refugee status were young, single men, you know, below 35. There are some families, there are some wives, and there are some children. In many cases, there are tens of thousands of unaccompanied children who are also mostly male, and they all seem to disappear. I think they've lost track of something like 10,000 unaccompanied minors at one point.
Now, I've heard estimates, and I think you mentioned it in your book, that as many as 300,000 immigrants have simply disappeared upon entering Germany, that the German government has no record of these people and they don't know who they are.
Exactly right. I was astounded when I saw this, and I said, well, look, you've got Germany where if you're coming to the country as a foreigner and you register in a hotel room, they take all your particulars and give them to the local police force. If you're an illegal alien, like many of these people are, you should be doubly checked as to who you are and what you're doing there. I mean, the Germans have the federal criminal police who have jurisdiction across the country and who cooperate with the local police in each of the German states, the lender. And then you've got the Internal Security Service, the Federal Office for the Protection of the Constitution. It's their job and the job of all of these police forces to keep track of people and to ensure that you have domestic tranquility and you don't have a gang of terrorists running loose in the country. And you need to know who is there and what they're doing. And I've seen German politicians and former judges rail at this and say, what have you done to our country? You have sworn an oath of office to protect and defend Germany and to promote the general welfare, and you're not doing it by letting in a wave of people who speak no known language, who have no ties to the area of culture, of religion, of history, or anything else, and suddenly you lose track of them all. And how does this happen? It's just astonishing.
A well-known author living in Germany told me off the record that it's dangerous now for women to go out at night and that the German government prosecutes people who speak out against immigrant crime. What do we know about this?
Well, that's unfortunately all too true. I mean, all the feminists in Germany, I'm surprised they're not screaming blue bloody murder at the demands that if they go out alone, they shouldn't do it. They should go out with a male escort. They shouldn't go out by themselves at night alone, that it's dangerous. They've had attacks all over the country, and they're still picking up. I've read how they've had knifings in Hamburg and a shootout in a nightclub in Konstanz in the south of Germany. And it's astonishing. There are demands for segregated gymnasium hours, segregated swimming pool hours, and people are balking at this or saying this is our country, we shouldn't have to adapt to the foreigners, and yet it's the other way around. And Merkel and her government are imposing sanctions on people for hate speech, and it's very broadly defined. If you go on Facebook and say that these people should be shot, they should be driven out of town, they should be tarred and feathered or something similar, it's not, you know, imminent death to these people. It's spouting off at politicians who don't do anything about this. Well, they get fined. They get suspended prison sentences. And one guy was thrown in jail with a big fine because he had said that Merkel and her ministers should be stood up against the wall and shot because they've abandoned Germany to a gang of aliens.
Is Germany's constitution under attack? What executive changes have been instituted by Chancellor Merkel? Now, we've just been talking about free speech. I guess that's something, huh?
Yes, indeed. The German constitution very specifically and flatly says that freedom of speech is inviolate. And it talks about speech itself. It talks about letters, it talks about telephone calls, it talks about emails, you know, electronic communications. And yet, when somebody speaks out like this, they're in a world of trouble because the government comes down on them. And the German government claims, oh, well, this is hate speech, and we have a section in the law against hate speech. Well, there's hate speech, and there's asking questions, there's demanding answers from politicians. And Merkel seems to have gone overboard on this, and she seems to have not only changed by executive order what free speech really means, she's also increased surveillance of Germans. They've increased controls on legitimate travelers at the border. They've gotten into the intelligence services reading people's emails and telephone conversations. They are going on about how we have to have security in Germany, and it's a security at the price of liberty, very much like the United States. Oh, we want to be protected from terrorists. We want to protect you from terrorists. And at the same time, they're cutting back on actual freedom. So it's not the right wing that's howling for men on horseback and the revival of Adolf Hitler. It's the center-left, the center-right governments of Europe, in particular Germany and France and Britain, who are engaged in investigating and controlling and secretly spying on people.
And with regard to crime, is there evidence that the German Internal Intelligence Service won't or can't do its job?
It appears so. I mean, there are two really well-known examples. One was this fellow, Anas Amri, who was a migrant. And he had stolen a truck in Berlin and driven it into the Breitscheidplatz Christmas market in the center of town, killing and wounding a number of people. And he was known to have had a history of being jailed in Italy. And he had been on a watch list by the German Internal Security Service, the Federal Office for the Protection of the Constitution. He had been on the American no-fly list. He had... at one point said he had told an informant for the federal criminal police that he wanted to do something in Germany. He wanted an AK-47 to do it with. Yet they didn't seem this was enough to arrest him or to follow him more closely, and in fact dropped their surveillance of him about 6 months before the attack at the Christmas market. There was another instance in southwest Germany in the university town of Freiburg, where this Hussein Kavari, an Afghan migrant, had raped and murdered by drowning Maria Ladenburger, a young 19-year-old, beautiful medical student, when she was bicycling home from a party. She, in fact, had worked at migrant homes trying to help out the people who were flooding Germany at the time, although apparently she didn't know her attacker. But in the case of this guy Cavare and Ladenburger, they kept a lid on it for months, and only because the social media got a hold of it, and then the press did anything come of it, and people started asking questions, what's going on, what's happening? Didn't you know this guy had been jailed in Greece for trying to throw a woman over a cliff, and he had been let out of jail early, and he skipped parole, and suddenly he turned up in Germany, and they couldn't deport him because he had no papers. That was the same story with the guy in Berlin at the Breitscheidplatz. He didn't have any papers, so they couldn't get rid of him. They denied his asylum claim. Yet at the same time, they had found several different documents in the truck and elsewhere listing several different identities and several different passports. So you really wonder, are they really this incompetent, or is there somewhere how a dark fifth column in the security services?
I'm speaking with J. Michael Springman. Today's show, Migration as Asymmetric Warfare. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Today is a fun drive on KPFA in Berkeley, and you've been listening to Mike Springman talk about his brand new book, Goodbye Europe, Hello Chaos, Merkel's Migrant Bomb. This new book of his is actually quite interesting. It just came out this May 2017. Let me read you the jacket. It says, as the world watches the destruction of Syria and the flood of refugees into Europe, few bother to ask some important questions. Who benefits? Who provides refugees with the resources they need to head north and west? Why are most migrants male, and why is Europe a favored destination? J. Michael Springman, author of Visas for Al-Qaeda, CIA Handouts That Rocked the World. That's his first book. That's a real classic. We're offering that today also. Offers answers to those questions. He argues that forced migration is a subtle form of warfare waged by U.S. foreign policy with a double intent to destabilize Middle Eastern nations and weaken Europe. As refugee numbers skyrocket, cultural and national conflicts in Europe seem inevitable. The wheels have been set in motion, and chaos is on the horizon. Goodbye, Europe. Hello, chaos. This is our premium today on Guns and Butter, our thank you gift for a $100 tax-deductible donation to a KPFA. Goodbye Europe, Hello Chaos, this new book about the migrations, that for $100 donation. And we're also offering his classic work, Visas for Al-Qaeda, CIA Handouts That Rocked the World. Either book for a $100 donation. And you know what, Erica, I forgot to write down the phone number. You can pledge online at kpfa.org. Let me bring up the phone number. I didn't write it down before I got on the air. Isn't that crazy?
So, Bonnie, the phone number is 1-800-439-5732. That's 1-800-HEY-KPFA. And for those who are in the 510 area code, that's 510-848-5732.
So, Erica, the 800 number is 800-439-5732. Thank you, Erica. Well, you would think that would be etched on my mind forevermore. That's pretty funny. So please give us a call on Guns and Butter. Support the station. Support the show. Support Michael Springman. Give us a call, 1-800-439-5732, or securely online at kpfa.org. $100 for Mike Springman's new book, Goodbye Europe, Hello Chaos. It's an interesting subject because it's very little talked about. And we go on in the interview to discuss how the media, particularly in Europe, but also here in the United States, doesn't really write much about it. It's kind of an unspoken subject, the disruption of Europe with migrations. And, of course, so many of the refugees are coming from war-torn areas because of the America's forever wars, but not all refugees are coming from war-torn areas. They're being directed toward Europe from all different kinds of directions. And it's quite interesting, Mike Springman's investigation into how this was put together and actually orchestrated. And, of course, we're mainly focused on 2015 and 2016 with regard to Europe and, well, actually Germany and Austria specifically. Those were the two key years of the mass migrations. 800-439-5732, $100 for Goodbye Europe, Hello Chaos, Merkel's Migrant Bomb. Mike Springman has done some investigation into Angela Merkel, the Chancellor of Germany, and interestingly enough, there's not really all that much known about her. She came from East Germany, the German Democratic Republic, and nobody knows a lot about her. Most of her background really isn't all that public. But he did talk about some of the things that he's been able to find out about her, but not a whole lot. That's Goodbye Europe, Hello Chaos, Merkel's Migrant Bomb, his new book, for a $100 pledge to KPFA at 1-800-439-5732. We also have his classic work, Visas for Al-Qaeda, CIA Handouts That Rocked the World. Of course, he was station chief there in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, in charge of issuing visas, and he was constantly being overruled, and visas were being given out to who he says were people that had no right coming to the United States, and they were coming here for terrorist training. That's Visas for Al-Qaeda, that for $100. You can get both books if you don't have either one of them for a $180 tax-deductible pledge to KPFA. 1-800-439-5732 is the number to call, and you can pledge securely online at kpfa.org. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Of course, this is Guns and Butter. 1-800-439-5732. Also in this story, there's the much bigger geopolitical picture with the United States government and whoever runs the government, I guess the corporations, viewing Europe as a competitor. So there's a strategy to weaken Europe and, of course, most importantly, to cut Europe off from making deals with Russia. The U.S. government does not want the Europeans, specifically, most specifically, the Germans, looking eastward toward Russia and making deals there. So there's a whole larger geopolitical picture to take into consideration. Goodbye Europe, Hello Chaos, Merkel's Migrant Bomb, our gift to you today for a $100 pledge. Please give us a call. Please support KPFA. Support Pacifica Network. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732 or securely online at kpfa.org. Well, Erica, why don't we get back and hear a little bit more of what Mike Springman has to say?
And what about the mainstream media in, well, in the United States and in Europe? Are they doing a very good job of covering the situation with the waves of immigration into Europe?
Not in my view. I mean, it pops up occasionally in the United States that they'd had a number of articles in the Washington Post at the time of the New Year's Eve attacks in December 2015. But by and large, if you have something, it's a small box item saying that in Konstanz there was a shootout in a nightclub or there was a knifing in Hamburg. But it's basically the bare bones. There's no explanation. There's no background. I, in fact, have gotten a questionnaire from a German publishing company saying that in Germany, the people don't believe the press is free anymore. And from what I've seen in the research for the book, that's pretty true. They kept a tight lid on what really happened on the New Year's Eve rapes, robberies, and beatings. And again, that only came out when people started talking to social media and to the press.
In terms of the migrations from the Middle East, etc., into Europe generally, from reading your book, it looked like there was a huge movement in 2015, 2016. How many people, do they know how many people in the last few years have actually emigrated into Europe from the South? And where does that situation stand today?
Well, they don't rightly know. I mean, they have estimates that go up and down. I mean, in Germany, they say at least 1 million people, if not more, have turned up there and registered. Other countries, such as in the Balkans, just simply passed them through, like Slovenia. They created a corridor where the migrants could move through. The aim is not so much to end up in Greece or Slovenia or Serbia, which are essentially poor countries, where in Serbia, a policewoman makes $300 a month, which is barely enough to buy a new computer. They're going north and west to the benefit-rich countries of Europe, and they come in such numbers that if they don't register, nobody can keep track of them.
Could you tell us about the tweets that supposedly came from Merkel and Germany, but which mostly came from the U.S., the U.K., and Australia, saying that Germany and Austria were the most refugee-welcoming countries in Europe? When were these tweets sent out? And what about the existence of net bots in these tweets? What are net bots?
Well, net bots, as I understand them, I'm not an expert on electronics, but I looked them up on Norton, the antivirus people, and they say that, well, they seize control of a computer and turn it into a repeater. You send something to this computer, and then the computer sends it out to another computer, and then that goes to still another computer. And these are all linked, and they send out whatever messages you want, and the computer and the computer operator don't know this. They've just been taken over secretly. And the tweets came out after the migrants started moving, and who did this and how they did this, I don't know. I think this is another one of these examples of the intelligence services' involvement, because your average guy doesn't know how to do this, and I can't see why a hacker would suddenly become interested in sending out welcoming notices saying, hey, go to Germany or go to Austria, it's benefit rich. Leave Syria, leave Libya, leave sub-Saharan Africa and go there. They just simply came and they happened, and nobody knows where they came from. And they, besides the U.S. And other places, large developed countries, they were coming out of Nepal and other small countries. And you really wonder about this. It's you can't pin it down, and it raises more questions than it answers, really, I think.
Well, now, obviously, a lot, if not most of these people that are migrating to Europe are coming because of the wars, the U.S. instituted wars in many countries, what, Iraq, Syria, Libya, etc., etc. In the preface to your new book, Goodbye Europe, Hello Chaos, Sylvia Gurmick says that refugees are normally organized in camps near their own countries, with the intention of returning. This does not seem to have been the case for many years.
Well, that's exactly right. And Sylvia had a lot of experience in this, working with non-governmental organizations involved with migrants and migration. And she had some ties to the intelligence service as well, as I understand it. She's entirely correct on this. I mean, you don't need to move an entire population from the Middle East to Northern Europe. The idea is to stop the war, stop the fighting, create a camp to tend to these people's needs, give them food and water and education, and then send them back home once you've repaired the broken water mains, the destroyed sewage treatment plants, and so forth. But this is not happening. The Americans have gotten the Europeans into this and have joined their forever war and are continuing to bomb and destroy whole countries and drive their populations out, who are then guided into Europe.
And what about the role of non-governmental organizations or NGOs? NGOs are found around the world in many countries. Are all NGOs American in origin, or do other countries sponsor them?
Well, other countries do. I mean, you've got George Soros' Global Society network of all his organizations in Europe and in Britain and Germany and so on. Then you've got a number of these non-governmental organizations that seem to have shadowy backgrounds. I mean, whether it was Welcome to Europe, W2EU, that seems to have no real basis in origin, no fixed base, but somehow they're bringing in migrants by the thousands. You have groups of ships. There's a German organization that I think it's called Sea Watch that gets ships into the Mediterranean to intercept the small boats the migrants are in and take them to safety in Europe and turn them loose. So it's everything from well-known organizations like George Soros' Open Society people, and you've also got this Sea Watch, and you've got Doctors Without Borders, Médecins Sans Frontières, and you've got organizations I've never heard of before that I mentioned in the book that somehow bring these people across as well. And they advocate for them, they agitate for them. They work very hard to bring these people across and make sure they get to the right place at the right time and they get themselves into the country so that they can't be thrown out again.
What about humanitarian NGOs in war zones? Do many of them serve as CIA front organizations? She seemed to indicate this.
Yeah, in particular, Mercy Corps does this. They're all involved in American war zones in Iraq, in Yugoslavia, and they come and they go and they come and they go. When things cool down, they move out. When they heat up, they move back in. And some of the Mercy Corps people have been arrested for espionage. So I think that these people's hands are not clean. And I've seen articles on RT where they've had a number of Germans saying that we are going to organize a group called Defend Europe to counter these people that are bringing in the migrants and the ones that somehow have ties to the intelligence services.
The United Nations created a commitment to responsibility to protect, R2P, in 2005, which allowed for Western peacekeeping missions or invasions based on humanitarian concerns. How does R2P work?
Well, as it's in the past, has been used as a means of American and NATO aggression against given countries, such as Yugoslavia. That's where the concept was first created. Then they used it to justify their invasion and destruction of Libya. And they keep bringing it up in terms of Syria, where we have to do something and have a safe zone, have a no-fly zone, have a safety corridor, et cetera. And it's basically a way of moving armed forces into a given country without that country's permission and without a declaration of war by the sending states.
Do the migrant streams constitute a strategy of tension? You've mentioned the strategy of tension in your book.
Yes, they do. It comes out of Kelly Greenhill's book, Weapons of Mass Migration, which came out about 7 years ago, which pretty much shows a blueprint on how to do this and what works and what doesn't work and why. The idea is that you weaken a country by moving people out of it, and then you weaken another country by moving these same people into it. The losing country loses its doctors, lawyers, and Indian chiefs. It doesn't have capitalists to finance businesses. It doesn't have professionals to manage these businesses. It doesn't have teachers to educate the children. And in the case of the alleged receiving state, although I don't know if you can call it receiving, they've been pummeled and pounded by this flood, they have to cope with this. They have to come up with the money to feed them, to house them, to educate them, to teach them a known language. There is no pool of native Dari speakers or Arabic speakers in Europe. And in the case of the migrants going into Europe, you know, how many of them speak German? How many of them speak Italian? But what happens in the receiving state is you have more tension because you have the groups of people who welcome them saying, oh, we have to help them. They're leaving a war zone. They have nothing but they can carry in their own two hands. We need to educate them and give them a place to live and integrate them into our society. And then you have the natives who say, well, wait a minute. It's our country. We get to decide who comes in, who stays, who goes, et cetera. And you have the fights then that are created between the migrants and the natives, and then the fights between the two groups of natives. So you wind up with tension and hostility and hatred on all sides.
Well, you mentioned the book by Kelly Greenhill, Weapons of Mass Migration, and you just got through saying that she wrote this book about 7 years ago. Was this book, Weapons of Mass Migration, was this simply analysis of what was already happening, or was it somehow a theory or a formulation to show how this could be done? What do you think of her book?
Well, the book itself was an analysis of some 64 different events, everything from the Haitian boat people to migrants being pushed out of North Korea in the hopes of weakening the North Korean government, plus a few others. But I think looking at the book and reading through it and analyzing it, I think it's a handbook on how to use these weapons of mass migration, how to exploit democratic societies. Because she says in the book in a couple of different places that the Achilles heel of liberal democratic democracies is that they have somewhere along the way signed conventions and agreements about migrants and asylees and helping them and bring them into the country if they're fleeing for their lives. And because of this, the migrants coming in say, well, wait a minute, you signed the Hague Convention on this or the international agreement on that, and aren't you contradicting yourselves? Aren't you being hypocritical? Isn't this hypocrisy? And she, in fact, terms this hypocrisy costs, that the people who suddenly can take a few people in suddenly think, oh, my God, it's not a few people. It's 1,000, it's 10,000, it's 100,000. And in fact, in her book, at one point, she says that one migrant is a tragedy, 10 migrants is a novelty, and 100 migrants are trouble. So it's if you look at her book, and especially look at the section on Korea, where you get non-governmental organizations involved, especially those with a religious cast, you can get people out of the country and trying to move them into South Korea and into China. And it failed there because the Chinese said, no, no, no. These are economic migrants. They're not fleeing anything except their own economic situation in North Korea. And the South Koreans, who welcomed them at first, saw that these people were not philosopher kings, but in a sense, troublemakers. And they said, well, we can't take care of 1,000 or 2,000 people. How are we going to take care of more? So let's block this. And that's what happened. But it seems to be working very, very well in Europe.
That's right. China didn't cooperate with that, and they blocked that, according to her book. Is this emptying out of one country and then flooding another country with people? This effectively is a destabilization device, right? I mean, how has this affected Europe?
Well, it's just turned it upside down. You got, for example, I remember seeing a press conference given by a city councilman in Munich who said to the city council there, look, we've got 50,000 migrants in Munich alone. They're housed in a sports stadium, and they're going to have to sleep on the ground because we don't have 50,000 air mattresses to put under them. They were housed in sport halls in a small village of maybe 10,000 people east of Stuttgart. They were put up in camps in France, and they've taken over Calais and are expanding in other places. And the French government is having fits because people are trying to hitch rides on trucks crossing through the Channel Tunnel to get into Britain, where they think the benefits are better. So it's a terrible situation there. There are places where the students in a in a public school, Muslim students won't sit at a table with Christian girls. And they have this cross-cultural problem that they can't seem to break. And yet they seem to believe, the German government does, that everything is hunky-dory, that, well, yeah, there are some issues and some irritations, but things are getting better. And it's not the case. It's all over Europe. People are raising serious questions and are questioning their governments, which ignore them. There's one case, and I think it's Denmark, where a guy brought his two wives and a dozen children in, and he claimed he was too sick to work and he was too sick to study Danish, and has recently gotten permission to bring another wife and eight more children over. And the government is having fits, saying, well, what is this? This guy is costing the taxpayer a fantastic amount of money every day for all of these people, and he can't work. So it's you have violence, you have inability to adjust. Initially it was things like Muslims had clashed with drunken Oktoberfest goers in Munich, or the more ultra-conservative of them seemed to think that some of the German girls, to their taste, were too skimpily clad, and they wanted them to cover up. And this, again, brought more tension, and it snowballed from there and into major issues.
You point out in your book that no European leader will state publicly that the migrations are caused by the U.S. wars.
Exactly. They all talk about, oh, we have to accommodate these poor people who are fleeing the tyranny of Syria. I, in fact, had a guy who had bought the German edition of my book talking to his sister, and he had sent me an email saying that his sister thought this was all conspiracy theory, that Bashar al-Assad was a monster, he was a devil incarnate, that the United States really has to be supported in its fight against terrorism all around the world. And anybody who questioned this was somebody who really didn't understand what was going on. And I think there's an awful lot of that. And the people, for the most part, see through a lot of this, a good bit of it at least, and see that the Americans and their wars are creating this problem. But no politician says this. Nobody comes out and says this is a major issue. This is tied to religion, ethnicity. This is tied to culture. And it all comes about because the United States and the European countries, now that they're part of the forever war, have destroyed Afghanistan, have destroyed Iraq, have destroyed Libya, and have destroyed Syria. And if you stop the wars and use the money that is being used to prosecute the wars from NATO and the NATO budgets of the NATO members, and use this for something productive, like send these people back home, have a Marshall Plan to repair the destroyed infrastructure, then you would have something that would be useful, and these people could learn a trade, they could learn a language besides Farsi or something like this, and be made better off. But instead, we're destroying their homelands. The real losers in all of this actually are the migrants, because they essentially have been dehoused, deculturalized, destabilized, and destroyed. They're being forced to fit into German society and French society and then Danish society. And what about their own society? They had a perfectly good society back home, and they've been driven out of it. So everyone loses, not only the Europeans, but the migrants.
In terms of the mass migrations into Europe, you talk quite a bit in your book, of course, about the outside help that has facilitated moving these, what are, I guess at this point, millions of people into the European Union. You talk about subsidies for smartphones, travel, the information highway, groups encouraging people to migrate. I guess it must have been a year or more ago that I saw all of these pictures on Twitter of these huge columns of people streaming across the countryside. And I think maybe one of them, this column of people, was trying to enter Hungary. These were massive amounts of people. So it had to be organized, right?
Exactly. I mean, they just don't suddenly wake up one morning and say, well, gee, I'm going from Damascus to Dusseldorf. And it's a long way to go if you're walking on foot. It's a good 2,500 miles, if not more. So, yeah, I mean, it was organized. It was organized, I believe, by the intelligence services, by these NGOs fronting for the intelligence services, and by people in the various countries. I think there was a column that marched from Hungary into Austria, and they were led by Syrians and Iraqis. So it's a very well-organized thing. You just can't go from the Middle East on foot to Central Europe. You require help. You don't have topographical maps. You somehow get these smartphones, which are not cheap in the region. I looked at prices in Syria, for example, and the phones they use to navigate with to find the smuggler in Turkey and find his price, these are cost as much there as they do here. And, maybe you can get a cheaper one or a used one or a rehabbed one or something like this. But still, where do the unaccompanied children get them? And if you're leaving the country with nothing but you can carry it in your own two hands, where do you get all the money to do this? The average wage in Damascus is something like $50 a month.
You write that, quote, U.S. social media organizations provide the wherewithal for the migrants overrunning Europe. The companies, particularly Facebook, provide a wealth of information to the illegals. What sort of information is provided to migrants on Facebook?
Just about anything you want. If you want to get a map, you can get it from Facebook. If you want the price of a smuggler someplace, you can get it on Facebook. If you want a weather report, you can get it from Facebook. George Soros is supposed to have had an app for Facebook to help him navigate the migrant routes. So just about anything you want, you can get electronically. And the first thing these people do when they hit a country is say, where can I get my cell phone charged? And how do I connect to the local Wi-Fi network?
That's the voice of J. Michael Springman. Today's show, Migration as Asymmetric Warfare. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. We're wrapping up a fun drive on KPFA. This is Guns and Butter. This is the last time we'll be coming to you. We want to encourage you to call to subscribe to KPFA for a $100 tax-deductible donation. We can send you Mike Springman's brand-new book, Goodbye Europe, Hello Chaos, Merkel's Migrant Bomb. You can get that for a $100 pledge by calling 800-439-5732. That's 1-800-439-5732. His new book, Goodbye Europe, Hello Chaos. Very interesting book. You don't hear very much about the migrations. And he's looked at this in detail. This is quite an interesting book. Also for a $100 pledge, his classic Visas for Al-Qaeda, CIA Handouts That Rock the World. That for $100. If you don't have either book, you'd like both of them, you could really help KPFA out by making a $180 tax-deductible pledge today and get both books by calling 1-800-439-5732. A $25 donation makes you a member of KPFA. You can pledge securely online at kpfa.org. In Goodbye Europe, Hello Chaos, Merkel's Migrant Bomb, former diplomat J. Michael Springman provides an in-depth analysis of the migrant flood, its causes, and what it means for Europe. Destabilizing nations through invasion and espionage furthers U.S. goals in the Middle East, he argues, creating migrant waves aimed at destabilizing the European Union in general and Germany in particular. Germany's own refugee program, designed to exploit migrants as cheap labor, made U.S. intelligence efforts all the easier. Springman's insider knowledge of U.S. policy permeates this insightful, sometimes terrifying look at a world where migrants become weapons, nationalism is condemned, and civil liberties hang in the balance. That's Goodbye Europe, Hello Chaos. Our gift to you today, Michael Springman's brand-new book, Merkel's Migrant Bomb. Give us a call, 1-800-439-5732. Please support Guns and Butter. Please support Michael Springman. Please support KPFA, 1-800-439-5732. it's a very interesting discussion. The weakening of the nation state, what's happening with the destabilization of European nations and all nations worldwide, really, is a destabilization effort at the nation state. With a weak nation state, it's much more, it's much easier for corporations to go in and plunder economically. So there's an effort afoot to break down borders, to break down nation states. And Michael Springman goes into the fact in his book, pardon me, that it's the nation state that protects your rights and your civil liberties. Without a state, without a government for a people, you're just going to have a mass of people, and who is going to protect your rights? It's a very interesting discussion. 1-800-439-5732. $100 for Goodbye Europe, Hello Chaos. $100 for Visas for Al-Qaeda, or both incredible books by Michael Springman, for a very generous pledge of $180. But we've only got a few minutes left, and I need some of you to go to the phone to support KPFA. 1-800-439-5732. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today's show, of course, is Migration as Asymmetric Warfare. Destabilization of countries also leads to a police state atmosphere, and Michael Springman goes into that. With the crime waves in Europe, increasing police state measures are instituted. There's more spying going on against people, etc. 1-800-439-5732. So it's an interesting discussion. This is a different book. You don't hear too much about this subject. Very important, Michael Springman's research on this subject. As the world watches the destruction of Syria and the flood of refugees into Europe, few bother to ask some important question: who benefits, who provides the refugees with the resources they need to head north and west, etc.? And, of course, as he points out, the biggest losers, of course, are the migrants. What a horrible situation to be in. And this is where millions and millions of people find themselves after what Michael Springman refers to as America's forever war. Please support KPFA by calling 1-800-439-5732. That's 1-800-439-5732. You can pledge securely online at kpfa.org. We need to do everything we can to keep the Pacifica Network healthy. We have 5 stations, and we need your financial support. You can tune in here for free at any time and listen to the radio without any commercials, but it costs a lot to keep the station going. 1-800-439-5732. I have about 1.5 minutes left. I do want to mention that this coming Sunday, October 6th, is the Petaluma Progressive Festival. That's their annual festival. That's from noon to 5 p.m. this Sunday, August 6th. That's in Walnut Park. That's Petaluma Boulevard South and D Street. The San Francisco Mine Troupe is going to be there. I will be there. I'll have a lot of books that I've offered on the show and copies of Guns and Butter, and I'd love to talk to you. So please come by, stop by. I'll be there all afternoon. I'd love to talk to you. This is Guns and Butter. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. And again, today's show has been Migration as Asymmetric Warfare. We're hoping that you will call and support Guns and Butter, support Pacifica, support KPFA, 1-800-439-5732, $100 donation for either book, Goodbye Europe, Hello Chaos, both books by Michael Springman, his classic Visas for Al-Qaeda, both books for a tax-deductible pledge of $180. But you need to make that call and make that call now. Thank you so much. 1-800-439-5732.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Flashpoints.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. Today we'll hear part two of a great 1994 talk by Michael Parenti, The Costs of Empire. 20 years later, it's still all true and nothing has changed. In a nutshell, Parenti argues that empire isn't about nationalism, it's about class and economics. Empires are ruinously expensive, but the expense is paid by the 99% in order to make the 1% even richer. Today, Parenti shows the many, many different costs of empire that we, the normal people, are forced to bear. Time is short, so I will stop talking now. Here is Michael Parenti.
People who think of empire solely as an expression of national interest rather than class interest are bound to misinterpret the nature of empire. Then they end up by saying, we are expansionists. None of us are expansionists. How many of us, raise your hand, were out there demonstrating, we want more war, we want more intervention, we want more corporate finance expansionism in the third world? How many of you did it? You see? I proved it right there. George Kennan describes U.S. expansionism at the end of the 19th century as a product of popular aspiration. The American people, quote, simply liked the smell of empire. So when people start writing like that, you know that they're really throwing the stuff around. You know, it's really a lot of hot air. Two liberal writers, Buell and Rothschild, and progressive, have commented, the American psyche is pegged to being the biggest, best, richest, and strongest, and that's why we do it. When a third world nation, be it Cuba, Vietnam, Iran, or Nicaragua, spurns our way of doing things, our egos ache. Is that right? Did you get that? Did you get an aching ego when you heard that some country was trying to develop its own independence? I mean, these countries do more than spurn our ways. They move towards social orders that directly threaten multinational corporate interests. Americans do not support this empire. In fact, Americans are seldom consulted or informed about covert actions or military interventions. On the rare occasions they are informed, when it's an overt, massive intervention like the invasion of Panama, let's say, or Iraq war, they have usually opposed intervention or have not given very enthusiastic support. Opinion polls during the Vietnam War show that the U.S. public wanted a negotiated settlement and a withdrawal. They even supported the idea of a coalition government with communists, even if the communists proved too victorious and would have won all the elections. They supported the idea of elections. Well, then who then does U.S. policy represent? Even take the Gulf War. Even the public's super patriotic yellow ribbon binge was not the cause of the war. It was a response to the jingoism. It was a response to the incredible media hype. Even as late as September of 1990, just before the aerial war started, a majority of Americans supported a negotiated withdrawal by Iraq from Kuwait, which, by the way, the Iraqis were exploring and willing to consider. And you remember Bush said, we give them only a week. No army could go in a week. And then, of course, he attacked as they were leaving. We don't go to war because the people just want that war. It wasn't true in the Gulf War. It wasn't true in 1898. What are the costs of empire to the American people? If you're an unemployed worker whose plant has just moved to Hong Kong, the first thing that might come to mind is the number of jobs that our empire costs us. As early as 1916, Lenin pointed out that at an advanced stage, capitalism would export not only its goods, but its capital, not only its products, but its entire production process. And that's exactly what's happening today. Most giant American firms export their capital, their technology, their factories, and their sales networks, and our jobs. Over the last 20 years, American firms have more than tripled their total outlay in the third world. U.S. capitalism is now producing 8 times more abroad than it exports. Many firms have shifted all their manufacturing activities to foreign lands. All the cameras sold in the USA are made overseas. Just about all the tape recorders, radios, bicycles, VCRs, typewriters, computers, and TV sets. One out of every three workers employed by U.S. national companies is now in a foreign country, and that process is continuing. Americans are also victimized as taxpayers and consumers. The multinationals can juggle their books from one country to another and pay almost no taxes, show high productivity in a low-tax country, low productivity in a high-tax country, and the like. The billions of dollars that they get written off, the royalties they have to pay on oil, for instance, gets written off as tax credits, not a tax write-off. I mean, not a deduction. It's not a deduction you make before you figure your taxes, a percentage of your taxable income. It's a tax credit, the bottom line. At the end, they can deduct it right from the taxes they have to pay to the U.S. Treasury. And every dollar, every billion and billion and billion that they don't have to pay is money that we have to make up either in a debt structure or by direct taxation. The goods made abroad by super exploited labor are, by the way, sold at as high as possible price on U.S. markets. You could hear people say, well, maybe I get a break as the consumer. They go abroad, but they produce those goods more cheaply, and I get to buy them more cheaply. That's not true. Now, come on, now be real. Be grown up. It's amazing people you run into, the kind of goo-goo baby-like thinking they have about the people up there in power, hoping that they'll be benign to us, you know. Maybe they're doing this for me. They're doing it for you? You think they went all the way to Indonesia for you? You think Nike has closed every single one of its factories in America and went to Indonesia, where they pay these young women in compounds, which amount to slave labor, they pay them 10 and 12 cents an hour? You think they did that for you? No, because when those shoes, which the final production cost is $7, when those shoes get back stateside, they sell them for $134. They don't go there for you. They go there for themselves to widen that margin, to get cheap labor costs so that they can then make more profits. When they go down to Haiti and employ people for $1 a day, and that radical President Aristide wants to raise the minimum wage to $2. The World Bank got him against the wall, said, you're going to go back, but you just drop that stuff about minimum wage and those crazy radical ideas. It costs 10 cents to make a baseball in Haiti. No, I'm sorry, wait a minute. 12 cents. It costs 12 cents to make a baseball. They stitch those baseballs in Haiti, which then sell here in the U.S. for $10 and up. What's the markup on that, 12 cents to $10? How many 1,000%? Even take off for transportation costs, whatever else. And nor do those overseas investments bring any great benefits to the people of the third world, as I said. You know, a lot of those investments lead to a worsening condition. The Brazil miracle of the 1960s, where Brazil's investments and products and exports and everything else went up, 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 and it's, oh, the prosperity coming to Brazil. That increase came with an increase in poverty. That as that land went for cash crop exports, coffee, sugar, beef, it was that much less land to grow rice and beans to feed the people. So there we now have explained a mystery. How in the last half century investment in the third world has increased so dramatically, and so has poverty. It's no mystery once you look at it in a little detail and just unpeel it. The same has been true of investments in Central America, the Philippines, Africa, and elsewhere. And then there are environmental costs. For years now, the poisonous pesticides, the hazardous pharmaceuticals that are banned in this country have been sold by their producers to third world nations where regulations are weaker or non-existent. And these poisons continue to cripple workers in the American chemical plants where they're made, and they reappear on our dinner tables in the fruit, vegetables, meat, and coffee that we import. And these pesticides now, we see, may be the cause of so much breast cancer in women and prostate cancer in men. With the passage of GATT, General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, when I was a kid, I used to watch the old George Raft gangster movies. A GATT was a gun that somebody held to your head and said, you do what I want, and you give me your money, whatever else. GATT is exactly that. It is really something even more pernicious than that. It's a circumvention and end run, a global coup d'etat against any kinds of popular sovereignty, any protections that we might have. It sets up an autocratic World Trade Organization that can make all decisions regarding environment laws, labor laws, consumer laws. It legitimates the importation of products made by child labor. We have a law banning products for child labor. It wouldn't work under GATT. That would be a non-tariff trade barrier. It undermines all sorts of public services as being unfair competition to private companies and the like. This is part of the price that we're paying from the internationalization of global capitalism. The chemical toxins and industrial effusions that pour into the world's rivers, oceans, and the atmosphere by fast-profit, unrestricted multinational companies operating throughout the Third World, devastating the lands with mining, timber companies, agribusiness. This is seriously affecting the quality of the air we breathe, the water we drink, and the food we eat. I mean, it's all one atmospheric envelope. It all kind of starts circulating around. Ecology doesn't know any national boundaries. When companies cut down rainforests in Central America, South America, and Southeast Asia, turning lush jungles into scraggly desert, that affects the quality of the air that's available in the whole world. 25% of our prescription drugs are derived from rainforest plants. Rainforests are the winter home for millions of migratory North American songbirds. The wonderful, great, glorious collection of North American songbirds, amazing species that we have, are dying out. They're going down in numbers dramatically. These birds are not just aesthetically pleasing, they are essential for pest control. The fewer birds, the more pests. The more pests, the more spraying and insecticide we do. The dumping of industrial effusion and radioactive waste may also be killing our oceans. If the oceans die, so do we, since they produce most of the Earth's oxygen. Over half the world's forests have gone compared to earlier centuries. The forests are nature's main way of removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. Today, the pollution buildup is transforming the chemical composition of the Earth's surface, accelerating the greenhouse effect, and also causing a variety of climatic destabilizations and also depleting the ozone layer. Additional costs to the environment are inflicted, by the way, the single biggest polluter on the environment in the U.S. is the U.S. military. It's used millions of acres of land at home and abroad for bombing runs and maneuvers. It causes long-standing damage to vegetation and wildlife. It contaminates the air, the soil, and the groundwaters with tons of plutonium, solvents, lubricants, lead, and all sorts of other kinds of toxic wastes. It has about 9,000 military specifications that call for ozone-destroying chemicals. It produces 90% of our radioactive waste. It stockpiles thousands of tons of lethal biochemical agents. In other words, one of the greatest dangers to the security and well-being of the U.S. public and to the planet itself is the U.S. military. Another cost of empire is the toll taken on enlisted ranks within the military. Military personnel are repeatedly killed in transport accidents, firing exercises, maneuvers, and other readiness preparations. About 2,000 non-combat deaths a year. 21,000 Americans have been killed in the military by accident in the last 10 years. 21,000, that's quite a number. You could drop that rate, you could cut that rate by two-thirds by cutting the military by two-thirds. That's my plan. How you could just immediately save, you could immediately save, look at that, you could immediately save 1,500 lives a year. If you cut the military, well, that would be by three-fourths. That's all right, three-fourths. Thousands of Army veterans exposed to nuclear tests after World War II, now dying of cancer. That one is very fascinating because then you get the argument of anachronism, the presentist argument, which is you cannot judge the actions of that day by today's standard. We know now. We didn't know those things then. We didn't know that radiation caused cancer. Well, if you didn't know in 1945 when you put those GIs in those shallow trenches just a few hundred yards from zero ground, that would cause cancer. Why were you and the other brass and the other army officers 2 miles back in lead-lined containers watching the thing from back there? Why weren't you in the trenches with the boys there? And why didn't you walk across the hot ground with them after the explosion? They knew. They knew the radiation. They know when they test people for radiation and inject them with these things. They know what the hell they're doing. We now see, by the way, that the Gulf veterans, thousands, tens of thousands of them, get seriously taken ill from something that happened there. There are other ways the Empire fights back. The narcotics that victimize whole segments of our population are shipped in through secret international cartels linked to CIA operatives. The CIA was active in the Golden Triangle in Southeast Asia in the narcotics trade. They actively supported the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, who were the biggest, today now the biggest exporters of opium and heroin from Afghanistan, the so-called Mujahideen freedom fighters. And also from Latin America, the cocaine, the CIA is implicated. That's not a conspiracy theory. That's not some kook. There are at least three congressional committees that have found, including Senator Kerry's committee, that have found that CIA operatives in substantial numbers have been involved in narcotics trade. And you got these pilots who are going back and say, yes, Senator, I flew down with a plane load of guns and I came back with a plane load of cocaine. And I had no trouble getting in. And there's maybe 400 or 500 planes that come in every year. And say, well, you know, it's such a vast frontier. How could we stop these planes? The sky is so vast. Who knows where they're going to land? Can you imagine, Dick Gregory said, can you imagine if there were 500 planes of Russian spies coming in every year? They wouldn't be able to stop them or find them? The cost of the Vietnam War. Let me just give you this example. Including veterans' benefits and hospitals, interest on the national debt, and the like, comes to $518 billion. The economist Victor Perlow pointed out, by the end of the Vietnam War, inflation had escalated from 1% a year to 10%. The national debt had doubled. Unemployment had doubled. Real wages started on their longest decline in modern history, American history. The U.S. export surplus gave way to an import surplus. And so the Republic pays for the costs of the Empire. There were human costs, too, in Vietnam. 2.5 million Americans had their lives interrupted. Many of them came back very shattered, very broken. 48,000 of them came back in bags. 300,000 were wounded, a good number with 100% disability. 55,000 have died since returning home because of suicides, addictions, alcoholism, etc. Tens of thousands have attempted suicide. African American and Latinos paid a disproportionate cost, suffering almost twice as high a rate in combat casualties. And that's no accident. That's not because the African American and Latino soldiers just had to pick up the gun and run ahead of everybody else. It's because they were put up in the most dangerous positions disproportionately. And also because they were in the army disproportionately. It's economic conscription. It's a voluntary army, but it's economic conscription. Who goes in? It's the guys who don't have many economic opportunities elsewhere, so they end up in the army. It's about the best break they can get, and that's why the casualties of those two ethnic groups were so high. Military spending has created record deficits, a runaway national debt that causes the government to borrow more and more money in shorter terms and growing interest. So you go deeper in debt just in order to service the debt. Almost 50 cents of every tax dollar we pay now goes for military spending and paying the interest on the national debt. I mean, you don't get anything for it. A debt that's paid to rich creditors at home and abroad. The U.S. used to be the biggest creditor nation. It is now the largest debtor nation after the Ronald Reagan, between Reagan, Bush, and Slick Willie, it's been good $4 or $5 trillion have been spent on the military. An incredible spending binge. Most of our financial woes can be ascribed to military spending and also to the cuts initiated on behalf of rich corporations and individuals over the last 10, 15 years. Greatest sums are spent for the development of the Navy submarine rescue vehicle than for occupational safety, public libraries, and daycare centers combined in all of U.S. federal spending. The cost of military aircraft components and ammunition kept in storage, just the stuff that's kept in storage by the Pentagon, not used, is greater than the combined allocations made on behalf of pollution control, conservation, community development, housing, occupational safety, and mass transportation. The total expenses of the legislative and judiciary branches and all the regulatory commissions come to less than 1% of the Pentagon's yearly budget. Newt Gingrich has got a great plan. They propose to cut the entire Food Stamp Act, $25 billion. The Women's Infants Children Nutrition Program, the best dollar the federal government spends for very poor families, where you prevent malnutrition and you prevent children being born malnutritioned and brain damaged and everything else. We probably end up saving money on it. It has the grand sum of $3 billion. We're going to cut it out completely. And they're also going to cut the school lunch programs that feed about 15 million children in America, millions of whom that's the only square meal they get in the whole day. We're going to cut it all out. And they're going to save the grand sum of $32.6 million, which is almost identical to the development cost of a new vertical takeoff Osprey assault plane, which Newt Gingrich wants to revive and put back in the defense budget. All of that for this vertical takeoff plane. See, I'm trying to give you an idea of what, I don't think Americans have a proper notion of how much we spend on the military and what really goes into it. 70% of all federal scientific and technological research and development funds go to the military. And very little of that has spin-off effect for the civilian market. In fact, in the technological areas where military spending is the highest, those are the very areas where the U.S. has lost the most ground in terms of trade and sales. Furthermore, Americans must endure the neglect of environmental needs, the financial and social decay of our cities, our transportation, education, and healthcare systems, the frightful social and psychological costs, the discouragement and decline of public morale, the anger, cynicism, and suffering of the poor and the not-so-poor, the militarization and violence of popular culture, the application of increasingly authoritarian solutions to our social problems, the utter impoverishment of political discourse, so that all these questions that I've been dealing with and talking about here, all the vital questions of political economy and human need are just not dealt with. Instead, we hear about crime and we hear about prayers in the schools, you see. That's Gingrich's big plan, isn't it? To have prayers in the schools. In schools, throughout this country, schools where children often don't have textbooks, where they may go and have 18 substitute teachers in 1 month, don't even have a regular teacher. Schools where you'll find 80 kids jammed into one classroom. Schools where you'll have 6 classes going on in the gymnasium with no wall dividers, where the kids can't even concentrate and hear each other. Schools where they don't even have pencils and papers. This guy's worrying, getting us concerned about prayers in the schools as the issue. And the media then focuses on prayers in the school. What kind of a prayer would it be? How much time would it be? And the like. And this is what occupies our time and distracts us. What we are witnessing, brothers and sisters, is the third worldization of America. I called it that back in 1989 when I gave a talk in Berkeley. It was George Bush and Voodoo Economics, I called it, and I said, we are moving toward, their goal is a third worldization of America, because their goal is that around the whole world, to get masses of people working harder and harder for less, so that they can have more and more. And what we see is just that. More and more luxury cars on the street, more people on the street. A dramatic growth in millionaires and billionaires. The return of tuberculosis and diseases caused by severe protein and calorie deficiencies that are usually seen only in the third world. Rising rates of infant mortality in poor areas. So when we talk about poor nations and rich nations, we mustn't forget that there are millions of poor in the rich nations and there are thousands of rich in the poor ones. There's a verse by Bertolt Brecht, and it goes as follows. There were conquerors and conquered. Among the conquered, the common people starved. Among the conquerors, the common people starve too. And so that's what we have. The lives and treasures of the people are squandered so that the patricians may pursue their far-off plunder. A party for Caesar, a party for Pompey, but where is the party for the people of Rome? And the point to remember is that these social conditions are not irrational. They're not aberrations of a rational system. They're the rational outcomes of a basically aberrational system. They are the outcome, one that organizes the labor and the resources of society around the process of accumulating as much capital for a few powerful interests at the expense of many at home and abroad, and at the expense of almost every human social value. What we have to do is appeal to the U.S. public and to people to resist the victimization by empire. Not to say to them, oh, don't be aggressive, oh, don't be defensive, oh, love your enemies, oh, if they threaten us, take the risk and try to be friendly to them. People get scared. When they feel their security is in jeopardy, they will be ready to support any kind of outrageous and horrible action. We have to appeal then to something much stronger and something much more vital and more immediate, which is their self-interest. Not their selfishness, but their self-interest. That is, the difference between selfishness and self-interest. Selfishness is you just take what you want at the expense of anybody else. Self-interest is when we see that we all have a common interest in this thing, and where really does our interest lie. We've got to understand, make people understand that the gargantuan global military apparatus they now grudgingly support at such immense cost does not serve their interests, and that to abolish it will not leave them prey to some foreign adversaries. We've got to help them understand that this empire, we've got to let them know or get out the message that this empire is paid for by their blood, sweat, and taxes, that it has nothing to do with patriotism, it has nothing to do with protecting them or protecting less fortunate peoples abroad. It has everything to do with victimizing them in order to feed the power and profits of the few. To lay down the sword and use our labor and national treasure for the peaceful reconstruction those so desperately needed at home and abroad is not to become a weak nation, it's to become a strong nation. Those people who say, well, you have a conspiracy theory that these people are running the whole thing. I think of this cartoon poster my son Christian has up on his wall. It shows two steers in the meadow, and one of the steers has an anguished look on its face, and it's saying, oh, I just discovered how hamburger is made. And the other steer is looking with a kind of a superior smirk and saying, oh, there you go, you leftist paranoids with your conspiracy theories. Well, we have got to, lest we all end up as hamburger, we have got to shout out and say all these things, as outrageous as they may sound, as iconoclastic as they may sound. This analysis I just gave you is not a Marxist analysis, although Marx wouldn't disagree with any of it. I can't help it if reality is radical. I didn't make it up that Nike pays them only 10 cents an hour. You say Nike pays them 10 cents. Well, you have a leftist perspective. I said, no, that's not a leftist. That happens to be reality. They are doing that. Some pundits and propagandists would label our desire to move in a rational direction and a peaceful reconstruction as weakness or folly or isolationism or dangerous pacifism. But we have another name for it: to wrest the wealth and power out of the hands of the military-industrial complex and the multinational investor class and give it back to the people so that they can become the agents of their own lives and social conditions. We have another name for that. We call that democracy, the victory of the republic over the empire. Democracy, and let's have more of it. We are so desperately in need of it. Thank you, brothers and sisters.
Michael Peretti, finishing up part two of a great talk from 1994, The Costs of Empire. Thank you for listening to New World Notes. newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust wishing you illegitimi non carborundum. See you next week, and ciao.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake-up call. me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No short.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. On today's show, you'll hear parts of an edited interview with Field McConnell on a January 2015 Richie Allen show out of the UK. Field McConnell was a U.S. Marine with an extensive background in naval aviation and was a commercial pilot. He's the global operations director of abledanger.net, and ABEL in this case is spelled A-B-E-L. On today's show, he's discussing uninterruptible remote control technology in airplanes in connection with the mysteriously missing Malaysian Airlines flight MH370 that allegedly crashed on March 8, 2014, and the four flights on 9/11. And here's a sample of what Field McConnell has to say.
Any credentials I may have, the only one that's important at all is the fact that when I found out that airliners had been illegally modified, I quit flying and started talking.
According to the Sun newspaper out of the UK, Malaysian Airlines flight MH370 became one of the world's greatest aviation mysteries when it disappeared without a trace. Analysis of its last moments indicate that it crashed at a high speed without a pilot in control. 239 passengers and crew were on board. Researchers say that they had been looking in the wrong place for the airplane. On January 17, 2017, the hunt for flight MH370 was officially announced as over by Australian officials. Supposedly, pieces of the airplane have been found with more than 20 bits of debris suspected or confirmed to be from MH370 have washed ashore on coastlines throughout the Indian Ocean. Field McConnell was contacted by the Malaysians to tap his knowledge about what might have happened to flight MH370. Here he is discussing this.
Yes, that phone call came to me on a Saturday. If I had to guess, and I'm not going to guess because it was a phone call, it wasn't recorded, and I don't have the date, other than I know it would have been at least 1 week after March 8th. And the reason I know that is the reason Malaysia called me was because the same day that Malaysia 370 was taken remotely, we put out, and when I say we have a network of people with many in the UK, but all over, probably on four continents, if not five. We have private citizens that are tired of being lied to by our governments and media, and our network, which is abledanger.net, and that's spelled ABELDANGER.net. Our network put out a YouTube, and to this day, and this is not an arrogant thing or a boastful thing, because I did not create the YouTube, a friend of mine that lives in Phoenix, the same day Malaysia went down, he put up a 6-minute YouTube that is titled Boeing, B-O-E-I-N-G, uninterruptible. That's not a correct word, but you get the idea. Autopilot. And about a week later, a person called me, and it's a professional person representing government interest in Malaysia and also Malaysian airline systems. And that gentleman called me in the afternoon of the Saturday, which would have probably been 1 week after Malaysia 370 went down. And he asked me if I could, right out of the opening gun, the first comment was, "Hi, my name is Redacted, Redacted, and I would like for you to come to Malaysia and explain to us face to face what happened to our aircraft." The gentleman who called me lives in Malaysia, and I don't want to identify him because I'm not sure why he called me to Malaysia. I don't know if he wanted to see if I was a threat to the bad guys or a tool for the good guys. But I was over there for 4 days. And on April 19th, I arrived there April 17th. The gentleman is not an American. He is a Malaysian. There's a lot of different ethnic groups in Malaysia. There's Malaysians. There's people from Singapore. There's Brits. There's expatriate U.S. There's plenty of Chinese people. But he was a professional person representing the government. And after spending 3 days with he and others from the 17th of April until the 20th of April, I told them, and this can be verified, what I'm going to tell you might seem shocking to some people, but I told them before I went to Malaysia that if they did not expose the mechanisms which took their aircraft off course from BITOD waypoint. Waypoint is a navigational set of coordinates, longitude and latitude. The BITOD is simply a geographical waypoint that the aircraft was programmed to fly over and then continue on a northerly course towards Beijing. But when the aircraft got to BITOD waypoint, it started a left-hand turn as if to turn back to Kuala Lumpur. Simultaneous to the turn, the transponder was disabled and the communication radios in the cockpit were disabled. And these are changes consistent with the Boeing uninterruptible autopilot being triggered from somewhere outside the cockpit.
Here he's responding to a question about if the aircraft companies would know about these remote control possibilities for their planes.
First of all, Lufthansa, the national airline of Germany, noticed that their brand new Boeing 747-400s, when they were delivered, and I believe the year they were delivered was 95, it was right around there. Their mechanics, they don't call them mechanics, you know, we all have to have different languages so we can be divided and conquered. And Lufthansa is one of the airlines that I've traveled most exclusively on when I'm going between the United States and Kazakhstan. But they noticed the mechanics, they're called techniques in Germany. They noticed these parts that they had not ordered. And I believe the tab was $800 million to reconfigure their brand new aircraft the way they ordered them. And so Lufthansa, if they didn't have super sharp techniques, they would be just like every other airline in the world, and they would be subject to the values of the leasing companies. And most airliners are leased, not owned. I don't know what the percentage is, but one case, very positive case, is Lufthansa discovered on their own the illegal modifications. Another very positive case is United Arab Emirates operates the biggest fleet of Boeing 777s in the world. And around June 21st or 22nd, the CEO, his name is Tim Clark, the CEO of Emirates, suggested that Malaysia was being rather irresponsible in not determining how their aircraft was taken off course. So once again, our Able Danger Network, and remember it's spelled A-B-E-L, not A-B-L-E, abledanger.net, we put out a radio interview, which also had a YouTube, and that YouTube can be found. The title, I believe, is CEO Tim Clark, Five Critical Questions. Because when Tim Clark, as well he should, complained that as the management person in charge of the biggest fleet of Boeing 777s, he said he needs to know how that 777 was taken off course. So we did a radio show and produced a YouTube that made him aware of the illegal modifications. And let me stop right here and say what makes the modifications illegal is not the fact that they're not put there for good purpose. What makes them illegal is the fact that no airline, no group of pilots, no group of mechanics, no groups of dispatchers, nobody knows these aircraft are illegally modified. I want to tell you these aircraft are all now effective drones. Now, I said there's a good reason for it. Yes, there is. Back when the aircraft were built, it was pre-9/11. In the case of the Boeing 777, the Malaysia 370 flight that went down was 17 years old, so it was built in 97, which is before 9/11. Before 9/11, people still thought humans could hijack airplanes, which at that time they could in many cases. But by the time the entire world airline system had upgraded to fly-by-wire, FBW, fly-by-wire, glass cockpit, in other words, very modern aircraft, to preclude humans from hijacking the airliners, all aircraft manufacturers, Boeing, Airbus, Embraer, Bombardier and Sukhoi, all of them have these uninterruptible autopilots, and that is to turn them into an effective drone if humans tried to hijack the aircraft.
Here he's responding to a comment that the public was never made aware of this new remote control technology that could prevent hijackings.
Yes, you're right. The traveling public, unless they've been, and I don't want to sound like the only game in town, but I am the only pilot that was called to Malaysia, and I'm the only pilot that I know of that quit flying because I could not get Boeing or my employer, Northwest Airlines, to admit to the fact that these things were installed. And they really should have admitted it because it makes aviation much safer. And let me tell you, the autopilots land the airplane and they bring them to a stop on the center line of the runway. And the pilot has to take positive action. Let me back up. I misspoke somewhat. The uninterruptible autopilot is capable of doing that, yes. But even the regular autopilot, if you have both autopilots selected and you do a Category 3C landing, the aircraft will land on the center line, it will stop safely, and then when the pilot wants to take control of the aircraft so he can take it to the ramp.
And now here he's responding to a comment about how MH Flight 370 couldn't have crashed in the ocean because it would have broken up into many pieces on impact and would have been easily located.
The aircraft was never lost. Not only do the airlines special operations, or excuse me, systems operations center, SOC, the system operations center monitors the location of every flight they have airborne around the clock, and so does the engine manufacturer. In the case of this Boeing 777, Malaysia's aircraft, the first one to crash, the second was Malaysia 17, but Malaysia 370, it is known exactly what time it landed and where, and it landed at Diego Garcia.
Here he's asked why someone would want to hijack MH Flight 370 and take it to Diego Garcia.
Well, one reason that's been proffered, one reason is because of either technology in the cargo hold or intellectual property in the minds of the 20 Freescale employees. There were 20 Freescale employees on board that flight, and they had the intellectual property and the patent for an efficient way to make aircraft disappear, not in the sense that Malaysia 370 disappeared, but to have less of a radar signature. And the patent was co-owned, and I'll say this slowly because it's significant. The patent was co-owned by the 20 Freescale engineers and a member of the Rothschild family.
And here he's asked if there's documented proof of what he just stated.
Yes, there is, and you wouldn't have to do too much Googling. Able Danger's chat room is active right now. I'm going to ask one of them to just go to abledanger.net and put in Freescale employees or Freescale engineers on Malaysia 370. We've written endlessly about this. We've written 15 books, about 90,000 pages of posts. We put out a post almost every day, sometimes two. And in the 8 years plus of putting out our precise and rather lethal post, two things have not happened. We've not been sued for libel, and we've not slipped on a banana peel.
And here he's asked about all of the people at Diego Garcia who would have to remain silent about MH Flight 370 landing there, and what happened to the people on the plane if they were landed in Diego Garcia.
I'll tell you what, the two key pieces of in the illegal modification, the two most offensive components, one is the Boeing uninterruptible autopilot, BUAP. The other is the air tranquilizing injector, ATI. Any of your listeners can Google right now these three terms, MH370 plus BUAP plus ATI. And you'll be up for days reading. And this is the information that I took to Malaysia. And I spoke to four or five members of the government of Malaysia, past or present or both. And I spoke to a gathering of 15 Malaysia Airlines systems experts, expert pilots, expert technicians, expert financial people, expert executives, dispatchers, fuel people, engine people. And I asked him point blank when I was introduced, I said, has anybody in this room of experts ever heard of the Boeing uninterruptible autopilot? Not one hand went up. Then I said, well, I'm going to be pretty surprised if any of you have heard about the ATI. This is how they murder people in airplanes, if they murdered them. The ATI will inject a colorless, tasteless, odorless gas into the cabin so that the passengers are very tranquil. And this is what could have happened. I like to try to stick to facts. Most of the time, I do have an opinion. My opinion, and this is only an opinion, so I hope it doesn't offend anybody. I think the aircraft was remotely captured by a malevolent force first, and then I think that elements of the United States military tried to save the aircraft from the malevolent forces. At the time of the incident, there was a multinational aviation exercise going on, two of them actually, involving the U.S., Thailand, Singapore, and Malaysia.
If you've been listening to this show regularly, then you know that with most, if not all, false flag events, there are drills going on either right before or at the same time as the tragic event occurs. And this is true for 9/11, the Oklahoma City bombings, the 7/7 London bombings, the Boston Marathon bombings, and the list goes on. According to Field McConnell's beliefs, drones were used on 9/11 instead of commercial aircraft. Next, he's asked why they would not just use the uninterruptible remote control on a commercial airplane instead of drones.
This is an opinion, but this is a very expert opinion. If I were in one of those aircraft, if I was flying United 93 or 175 or American 11 or American 77, and I realized that another controlling agency was controlling my aircraft, I would do everything humanly possible to disrupt the control of that aircraft, because not knowing where it's going, I would assume it's not going somewhere on a benevolent mission. And that's why it's so imperative that the airline companies, the FAA, Federal Aviation Administration in the U.S., the JAA over in Europe, all of these aviation agencies, they all know what I know, because I communicate directly with them. But this truth is so vast that they feel that if the truth of 9/11 and 7/7, 9/11, Malaysia 370, Malaysia 17, and the recent QZ8501, if this truth is embraced, and it won't, it'll be by people like you and me, not by the mainstream media, then suddenly all of these security harassment things that are making our lives more difficult, like security at the airport, the railroad station, athletic events, all of this security stuff is for naught, because terrorism is not possible in airliners. The only people who can terrorize an airliner are the people that not only know about the remote control, but have the mechanisms and the protocols to interrupt the path of an airliner. If I were on an airliner today, and I knew that it had been taken over by the Boeing uninterruptible autopilot, I would just order another beer and relax, because the technology is better than pilots.
And here he's commenting on an incident where he felt someone was trying to take over a plane he was piloting.
I can send you the incident report. Off the top of my head, it was the 12th of December of 2008. I was in an Airbus A320 at Atarau, and I believe that is spelled A-T-Y-E-R-A-U, Kazakhstan. Keep in mind that the reason I was in Kazakhstan is I'd reported Boeing aircraft and uninterruptible autopilots, and then I retired in a 10-minute decision. In America or the United States, what they do to pilots that talk too much is they send you to a physician, a doctor first, then they send you to a shrink. And the game they're playing, it's not real obvious, but it's real important. If you don't shut up, the shrinks will give you a diagnosis which will eliminate you from ever being an expert witness in court. And see, that's the game they play. It's not about ego. It's not about money. But the last name, well, David Cameron, I think you know that name, and Nick Clegg. Nick Clegg, David Cameron, the Royals, Barack Obama, and the Department of Justice, the last person in the world they want to see in a courtroom talking about remote capture technology of airliners is me. And that's just too bad, because I'm coming to Telford, England to speak on March 1st. And prior to my traveling, I'm going to send a letter to a judge whose name is Rosemary M. Collier, and I'm going to demand $2.93 billion, because after I expose this technology, 1,404 victims on 10 different airline flights have died in a manner consistent with what I warned them about. And I warned them, my letter of 10 December of 2006, a 66-page document regarding the patents of the Boeing Uninterruptible Autopilot from 1953 through 2013, and also the incident report in Atyrau, Kazakhstan, where the aircraft was loaded extremely aft CG. In other words, it was so tail heavy that it took off 40 knots too soon. And I don't want to get into the pilot talk, although I can do that fairly well still, but we became airborne 40 knots before it was safe to be airborne. And so the Airbus is flown by a side stick controller. And because I had lots of experience and I didn't care about flying anymore, I always had the co-pilots fly because they're young and they need experience. But when this airplane became airborne at night in a snowstorm, I immediately said in English, and my English is different from yours, so imagine if you're a Russian. So I'm telling this Russian co-pilot, not a Kazakh, but a Russian, I said, I've got it. That's all I said. And I start controlling the airplane. And put yourself in his seat. Here we are in a snowstorm at night, poor visibility, and I say, I have it, and then the nose of the aircraft goes down. I'm sure he thought we were going to fly into the ground. So to keep me from flying into the ground, he pulls his stick back, and we start doing what's called a PIO, pilot-induced oscillation. And I told him a second time, I've got it. And then the third time I said, I've got it, I mustered superhuman strength, and I pushed that guy right up against his side window. And I don't know how I did it, because I would have been 59 or 60 years old then. And I'm not the biggest guy in the world. I'm not the smallest guy. But I pulled this guy right out of his seat and stuffed him up against the window. And that was adrenaline. And we did fly out of it safely. But I'm trying to be humble, but I'm also trying to be honest. The only reason we did not crash is because I was a Navy-trained F-16 experienced pilot, and I knew intuitively that if we didn't stick the nose down, we were going to die.
And next, he's responding to a question about, were the passengers on the four 9/11 flights murdered?
Yes, they all died in Whiskey 386 Alpha Airspace, except United 93. That airplane was destroyed by technology over Shanksville, Pennsylvania.
And now he's asked about Hani Hanjer, the alleged pilot of Flight 77 that supposedly hit the Pentagon on 9/11. He's asked, could Hani Hanjer have pulled that off? And could he himself, as an experienced pilot, have pulled it off?
A transport category aircraft is stressed for 2.5 positive Gs and 1 negative G. And to do that 270-degree right-hand descending slice-back maneuver from 350 knots at the top to 500 knots, 15 feet above the grass, you'd have to pull 4 to 6 Gs, which means you'd either pull the wings off the aircraft or you would hit the ground because you couldn't turn efficiently in that amount of space. Fighter pilots and acrobatic pilots of some types have G suits, which compresses your lower leg and your thigh and shoves all that blood back up into your upper torso and your head.
And here he's asked, does he have hope for the United States, or is he ashamed of it?
No, I'm not ashamed of it. My own sister is one of the most evil people in the United States of America, and she and others like her are committing treason. They know they're committing treason. In the case of my sister, she is the individual, it appears, that got Barack Obama his passport when he changed his name from Barry Swatero to Barack Obama. My sister was a government employee at that time. She has been in a lot of different government jobs, and she's been treasonous every step of the way. No, they should not be worried about traveling on aircraft. What they should be worried about is remaining silent. In other words, the quicker that the truth gets out that every glass cockpit, fly-by-wire, airliner is a drone, we the people of the United Kingdom, the people of Canada, the people of Japan, the people of Zimbabwe, the people of Kenya, the people of Indonesia, we the people will force they, the elite scum, to stop using this wonderful life-saving technology against us. And they're doing it simply to take out people they need dead and to make reinsurance profits. The 10 aircraft, which I didn't mention, but I can if you wish, but the 1,404 people that died on those 10 aircraft, they were insured for $165,000 apiece, but there's reinsurance for tenfold.
And now he's out of time and asked to wrap it up.
Tell people not to worry about flying. It's safer than driving to the airport.
And again, you were just listening to highly experienced pilot Field McConnell discussing his views on Malaysian flight MH370 and the flights on 9/11. You can decide whether you believe what he has to offer or not. And again, his website is abledanger.net. And that's able, A-B-E-L. So abledanger.net. And again, I want to thank Richie Allen of The Richie Allen Show for doing this excellent interview with Field McConnell. And just a reminder that 9/11 wake-up call shows are archived at the website radioforall.net. And that's the digit four, so radioforall.net. Once on the site, search under my name, Cheryl, with a C. It's on page 3 of the C's, and the show should pop up in chronological order. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
And this is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and myself, Mimi Rosenberg.
And we talk with Herb Boyd, author of Black Detroit, A People's History of Self-Determination, a book that chronicles the history of African Americans in Detroit. Multi-Grammy winner and Queen of Soul, Aretha Franklin. Well, she's known for such hits as Respect. Aretha came up with her family from Tennessee to Detroit as part of the great migration out of the South of African Americans to the North. And in Detroit, she began her career as a child singing gospel at her father's church, the minister C.L. Franklin, in Detroit. And in 1985, Aretha's voice was declared a Michigan natural resource, a Detroit natural resource. Well, Sister Franklin helps us get into the spirit of Detroit, which we will momentarily delve into with author Herb Boyd's Black Detroit, A People's History of Self-Determination. But first, to provide a bit more ambiance for our discussion with Herb Boyd, let's listen to General Baker, a co-founder of the Dodge Revolutionary Union Movement, DRUM, and the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, straight out of Detroit.
Let me tell you, I'm homegrown. I was born here in Detroit in September the 6th, 1941. Let me just say this. The Detroit Rebellion in 1967 is a defining moment in this city's history. I at that time was working at the Dodge main plant. We were working 12 hours, 7 days a week. I didn't get off work on the afternoon shift to 3 a.m. in the morning. And everybody that got off with me went to various blind pigs all over the city. It was part of our life. So when the rebellion broke out about 6 o'clock that morning on 12th Street in Claremont, I was right there, Johnny, on the spot. I was living 3 blocks from there on Gladstone. After the police came and tried to raid the blind pig, they were surrounded by about 100 workers on the street that started throwing bricks at the police. I was arrested on the first night for violation of curfew and did 15 days in Ionia State Penitentiary waiting to come back to trial. It's a lot of characteristics of the Detroit Rebellion that was different than other rebellions. First of all, everybody proclaims that the Detroit Rebellion was integrated. First person killed in the Detroit Rebellion was a white worker that was looting a store down on Trumbull. When they carried me to Ionia, I had two white guys on my bus that was arrested for sniping. Secondly, the Detroit Rebellion is the only one that had an assassination that took place during the course of the rebellion, and that's the Algiers Motel incident that no longer exists. First thing they did was rename it to the Desert Inn, and that lasted a few years, and now it closed it. And when you get to Virginia Park and Woodward, it's a gated community with a brick wall there, and the Algiers Motel have been wiped off the pages of history. And when you go to the school systems in the city, you can't find the book, the Algiers Motel incident, because they don't want kids to know about it. The other factor of Detroit Rebellion that made it different was they arrested so many people. They arrested over 7,000 people during the Detroit Rebellion. They sent us to Marquette, Milan, Jackson, up with me at Ionia. They filled up all the prison systems in the state. And when they was finished with that, they sent the rest of the people to Belle Isle. So when you talk about Belle Isle as a place for lecture, it became a jail. We called it Belcatraz. The other factor I think is important to know that those National Guard shot up this city. Anybody that went into the rebellion that didn't hate the police had to hate them when the rebellion was over. They shot over 150,000 rounds of ammunition with those 50 caliber machine guns over the city. They had so many shell casings laying on the ground that we picked up the empty 50 caliber machine gun shells, put rawhide on them, and wore them for necklaces as a symbol to the rebellion. I don't know if any of y'all remember that. But the biggest lesson that we learned out of rebellion was that when they established curfew, if you got sick, you couldn't go to the hospital. If you got hungry, you couldn't go to get no food. But if you had a badge from Chrysler, Ford, or General Motors, you'd get through the police line, the National Guard line, and the Army line to take your butt to work. We learned a fundamental lesson out of that, that the only place that black people had any value in the society was at the point of production. And that's why we turn our efforts towards organizing in the factory. And within a year's time after the Detroit Rebellion, Drum was born. And that was the basis of our struggle and the drum movement that grew out of that. The stress I wanted to make was where the struggle to organize the workers came from. It grew out of the rebellion. We learned a fundamental lesson, took that lesson, applied it, and was victorious with it for a while.
Because that was the summer of 67. And usually, Herb Boyd excites and stimulates and makes me even madder at the systemic inequities that he reveals as a journalist for the Amsterdam News. But when he pens one of his numerous books, like his most recent, Black Detroit, A People's History of Self-Determination, he takes me on a breathtaking odyssey through the most intimate moments of a people's quest to survive, to liberate, and accomplish self-determination by an indomitable spirit, a magnificent cultural expression, intellectual depth, and humanity. And I want to start that odyssey going back to that clip from General Baker, who started the Detroit Revolutionary Union movement, which influenced, you see, it was Detroit, and it was the General Bakers, and it was the black workers of the Dodge plants and so on that influenced movements of rebellion around the country. Herb, it is good to have you with us.
Thank you, Mimi.
So let's begin with the rebellions in Detroit and with people like Baker, who are part of your odyssey that you depict for us in your very, very important book.
Let's go back to kind of append a few more comments and observations about the Dodge Revolutionary Union movement and subsequently the League of Revolutionary Black Workers. First of all, I worked at Dodge, Maine myself. I left 2 years before the rebellion. After Malcolm's assassination in February 21st of 1965, you know, I had already left the plant with the intentions of coming to New York and reuniting with Malcolm, because I was with Malcolm before I went into the service in 1962. I was in the Army from 1962 to 1965. And when I came out in January of 65, I got a job at Dodge, Maine. So I worked there for about a month and a half. And then when Malcolm was assassinated, you know, that pretty much ended my dream of coming to New York. And I went to Wayne State University in the fall of 1965. But while I was at Dodge, Maine, I was able to connect with a number of the workers there, including General and Chuck Wooten and Ron March, all of them who were part of the whole origin, the seminal aspects of the Dodge Revolutionary Union movement, because it was a wildcat strike. General didn't get into specifying all of the reasons for the uprise of black workers in those plants, because for us, UAW meant you ain't white. And the rank and file, we figured we just was not being represented properly by the union. And so a wildcat strike ensued, And one of the reasons for that was that the assembly line was going, you know, absolutely ridiculously fast. It was inhuman, 73 cars an hour. I did just about every job at Dodge Main because when someone didn't show up to work, I was a swing man and I had to do their job. Consequently, I worked all over the plant. One of the toughest jobs I had was in the wet deck where you take the prime off, you know, with a buffer. After a while, your hand just cramp up, and then your filaments of paint are flying into your skin. I got a skin infection as a result of working on the wet deck. So I knew exactly, you know, some of the horrendous aspects of working at Dodge Main that led to the workers' revolt there. And then later on, when I got to Wayne State University, I was in a position because the 67 Rebellion, we used that as a wedge that we had to hold the university hostage. We kind of intimidated the administration there and began to make demands in terms of black studies, because this is a period of time, about a year before black studies really got the kind of critical mass in 1968. So we were like right in the beginning at Wayne State University, students there, because many of them had worked in the various plants around the cities who were lucky enough to get into Wayne State University, because so that was one of the demands that we made, is that we needed an increased enrollment of African-American students at Wayne State University, because here's a university that's located right in the heart of the black community, but we're not represented on campus. So when the rebellion broke out in the fall of 1967, I was a part of those students who began to make demands on the administration, have black studies and classes of African-American experience included in the curriculums, that we have an increased enrollment of African-American students on campus. And as a result of that, I ended up teaching the first classes in African-American studies at Wayne State University. And I was in a position then to facilitate the arrival of many of my former workers at Dodge Main, then became students at Wayne State University. It's a really, it's a story I get into in a very extensive way, you know, inside of the book Black Detroit, because Wayne State University, of course, was a hotbed of political activism. But after a while, you know, with the whole inclusion, this here invasion of young blacks, you know, coming on campus, we had the kind of army there to begin to make those demands reality to those demands. And so the administration surrendered and began to give us what we want. But the 67 Rebellion was important because it provided us with the kind of a threat that we could bring, that the possibility, the potentiality of that uprising breaking out on campus was a very real thing.
Your book seems to me to be, it's an odyssey. It's a personal odyssey. It's a personal odyssey that takes place within Detroit. And I was thinking as I was reading the book that, you know, surely Detroit must have been the capital of 20th century African America, as you, native son Herb Boyd, recounts the centrality of a number of dates and events. I mean, you go back to look at from the American Revolution, for example, how pronounced issues of the Underground Railroad, of the black abolitionists, and the stories that are within the book, are just kind of see this as an odyssey from one experience in one period to the other. But made me think of Detroit as the capital of 20th century Africa, African-American life.
You're absolutely right. The centrality of Detroit, kind of a microcosm in terms of the story of the black experience in America. One of the reasons is because if you go back to the beginning of the 18th century, because Detroit was founded in 1701, French explorer Cadillac, he arrived there and established Fort Pontchartrain. He had this here vision of building this city, this fort here. And, of course, the indigenous population, we can't forget the Miami and the Ottawa, these Native American populations that resided around here that had to be really tamed, if not destroyed, these conquistadores who came in. But anyway, what happened with that is that slavery, by 1736, we have the real introduction of African American slaves Indian slaves also existed at the same time. They call them either the Pawnees or the Pawnees. But nonetheless, they all were captives, and they were held in bondage. And a lot of people don't know about slavery existing in Detroit. In the same way, it existed in New York City. As a matter of fact, New York City at one time had more slaves than in Charleston, South Carolina. There's more than 100 slaves in Detroit in 1840. And that's where it prompted the rise of the abolitionist movement in the city. And it was led some very formidable individuals like William Lambert and George D. Baptiste, William Webb, Madison Lightfoot, these individuals who were part of the Underground Railroad. In fact, William Lambert, they said that, and maybe a bit of an exaggeration, that he some 40,000 individuals passed through his embrace. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Detroit is located right across the river from Windsor, Canada. So by 1850, which you had a Fugitive Slave Act, that means you had to go a little bit further because the bounty hunters were on the wild, and they would just abduct. They would grab people, black people off the street, whether they had their papers or not, with the whole idea of taking them back to the plantation to get even a more of a reward in terms of the bounty. So here's these black abolitionists, and they were just so absolutely creative, so inventive. They put together what they call the African-American Mysteries, which was the Order of Men of Oppression, which they used all kind of secret codes and passwords and handshakes to ensure the safe passage of these runaways, these fugitives from the plantation. Well, in 1833, we had the first major riot in the city of Detroit. So what I do in Black Detroit, though, is I begin to center the city, you know, as being this here kind of repository, this here archives of our history as they arrived in the city. You're beginning with the slave period right on down through the 1860s with the Civil War, because we had like a major riot in Detroit in 1863, similar to the draft riots that occurred in New York City. Mm-hmm. In other words, throughout the book, I try to draw some parallels between what's happening in Detroit and other cities around the country. So if you get beyond the slave period and into the whole migration, and in the 1920s, when Henry Ford made that $5 a day offer, again, Detroit is pivotal because, you know, if you look at Alabama, for example, my mother arrived in Detroit. She was 21 years old when she arrived in Detroit in 1941. You go back and look at William Lambert. When he arrived in Detroit, he was 21. And back in 1838, when he arrived in Detroit, he was 21 years old. So you have this here kind of young people who arrived in the city because they were attracted for a number of reasons. Of course, a labor question and working in Henry Ford's plants, that was going to be like a major inducement for a number of people to kind of pack it up and get out of Mississippi, Georgia, and Alabama, running away from Jim Crow, the Ku Klux Klan, the boll weevil, and looking beyond the cotton curtain, you know, into the so-called promised land.
The history of the trials and tribulations, the history of racial oppression, which punctuates all of the book. But while it does that, there is always the sense of uplift and the enormous creativity and coming together of Black Lives Matter in the most extremely exciting way. And so we can't not mention Motown. For sure, but I'm going to back into it through one of my favorite musicians, Yusef Lateef, The World of Jazz. And that's also a very vibrant and real part of the book, the cultural expression of Black life in Detroit.
You're absolutely right in terms of the kind of cultural, but also the dance, the theater, the literature, when you start talking about the evolution of African-American publishing, for example. One of the seminal moments is Broadside Press that was established by Dudley Randall in Detroit. You know, one of the things I do, and of course the music is so important for me, particularly Yusef Lateef, since I worked with him on his book, The Gentle Giant, his autobiography. And I just recently returned from, last Saturday I was at the funeral out in Newark, you know, for Jerry Allen, just a phenomenal musician who... I've met her when she was 16, 17 years of age, fresh out of Cass Tech, and she hooked up with a number of the music organizations that I was affiliated with including the Jazz Development Workshop and the Metro Arts Complex and the Detroit Jazz Center and the whole Strata Concert Gallery, all of those different kind of musical developments around jazz. You know, I was involved with it right from the beginning. Jazz Research Institute, I started that and was housed it at the Wayne State University when I was running the Black Studies program there. So jazz is always important in my life, you know, all the way back to the 1920s when you had McKinney's Cotton Pickers there. So one of the things when people say Detroit, first thing out of their mouth, talk about Motown and the whole genius of Berry Gordy back in 1958-59 when he put together Motown Records, he just plucked from the kind of reservoir of talent that existed in the city. And I grew up with a lot of those individuals, went to intermediate and elementary and high school, you know, with people who became, you know, the great stars, the Temptations, the Four Tops, the songwriters like Brian and Eddie Holland, Lamont Dozier. Because I lived in the Jeffries Project, you know, right across the hall from Smokey Robinson's cousin. So whenever Smokey and Claudette and Pete and them would show up to do their rehearsals, the doors would be wide open so I could just kind of move right on in there and be a participant. My whole music interest was developed as a result of these close associations, the kind of fortuitous opportunities I had to be in so many different places. My mother was moving every two or three years we seemed to be moving. So consequently, I grew up all over the city and had opportunities to be in touch with so many different aspects, you know, of the city's political, social, cultural, economic development. When you go back to the 1960s when the music is just bustling in Detroit, it's like a cauldron, you know, of musicians who could be members of almost every major ensemble. In the 1965 to about 1970, you could not look at a major ensemble, orchestra, or band, quartet, quintet, quartet that did not have an African-American musician in the membership. I mean, if you look at the great, you know, formations that Miles Davis had, for example, the bass player there was Paul Chambers, you know, and on and on, you know, for whether you had, like, Yusef Lateef had around him mostly Detroit musicians who went on to greater fame and fortune. So Detroit, you know, fed the music industry in the same way that we fed, you know, the automobile industry. So we were at the point of production, as General Baker talked about. You know, some of those workers in the plants were also musicians by night if they had were working on a day on a day shift. And if they were working on a midnight shift, you know, as I was, they had other opportunities to do it in the daytime and working at other cultural organizations, you know, writing their poetry. I remember Ron Milner. I grew up with him, a very fine playwright. You know, he went to Northeastern High School, kind of my rival because I was in Northwestern High School. And so you had this athletic thing also in Detroit. It was very, very competitive, and particularly Cass Tech and Northwestern, it was in Miller High School. So all of this here, I talk about, you know, the education, the whole history of education in Detroit. Again, we were pivotal because some of the first public school systems of any real impact and significance came out of Detroit, you know, going all the way back to the 1840s, 1850s, with Fannie Richards, who was the first African-American teacher and to integrate Detroit public school system. So we see seminal moments, you know, the arsenal of democracy. Detroit, again, is right in the center in terms of the war machine that was developed. My mother, again, not so much a Rosie DeRiveter, but she worked in the various plants because there was opportunities for women to get to jobs because a young man was being drafted, conscripted to go off and fight in a war. So it opened up opportunities for women to work in the plants. But as soon as the war was over, then they were dispatched back to either the housewives or, if they're like my mother, who was a domestic servant, she ended up going back doing housework in the suburbs of Detroit, which she did all of her life, and her story is a part of the book, though, Mimi. And if you have a close reading of it, you know, people would discover exactly who she was, because she was at all of these very important moments in Detroit's history, the whole migration, the second migration in the 1940s. She was a part of that. And when the whole war broke out, again, she was a part of the arsenal of democracy. We had major incidents of the police brutality in the city, the killing of Cynthia Scott. She lived right upstairs over us in 1963 when she was killed. We knew her very well. We called her Bebe back then. And that stimulated a lot of activity. Members of Uhuru, which is Swahili word for freedom, and also who were connected later on, would be connected to the Dodge Revolutionary Union Movement, the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, had begun to kind of cut their eye teeth on struggle going back to the 1962-63 period when we had a lot of social political activism in the city. So Detroit is like, you know, kind of key to understanding the Odyssey, the whole struggle of self-determination by the black people in America.
Your book is the story of Detroit, but it's the story of the black odyssey of racism and oppression and the habitual overcoming to build and enhance whatever environment people of African descent find themselves in. Well, I will tell you that, you know, I will go back to, which is still part of your odyssey on the African-American experience and how anybody that reads about it from your perspective will be so enriched. Herb has taught black studies for at least 30 years at various...
almost 50 now.
Almost 50. Am I behind on that? He's an extraordinary, facile, comprehensive writer. The prose just seeps into your soul, literally and figuratively. And I must encourage all of you to read Herb Boyd's Detroit, A People's History of Self-Determination, and it is a people's history of self-determination. If you care about the quest for democracy and a people's efforts to establish it for all people to stand on the shoulders of those who have fought the most diligently and comprehensively for it, this is the book for you. Herb Boyd's Detroit, A People's History of Self-Determination, and thank you for gracing us with your presence.
Well, the pleasure was all mine.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Way Out.
started going to mosque and I started reading about Islam and all that. And ironically enough, it was through that experience is when I actually finally started to accept who I am. I had a sexual relationship with also one of the imams. I just met him online. And then I started going to that mosque more often and then I saw him there. I was like, oh, awkward.
You're here, you fear, we're used to it.
Life is so easy for the straight white male.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Germany's marriage equality law will make October more festive. A privacy case in India's high court could bring sodomy law repeal, and the real life of a gay Canadian Iraqi novelist parallels his fiction. Those stories and more this week because you've chosen This Way Out.
I'm Jessica Andrea.
And I'm Michael LeBeau.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending July 22nd, 2017. President Frank-Walter Steinmeier announced on July 21st that he'd signed Germany's marriage equality bill into law. The announcement couldn't have come at a better time. Berlin hosted its annual Christopher Street Day Pride Parade the next day. Germany began offering less-than-equal civil partnerships to gay and lesbian couples in 2001, and despite recent polls showing public support at a record 83%, equality came only after Chancellor Angela Merkel, who personally opposed the legislation, finally allowed her party MPs a free vote. Opponents are asking the notoriously conservative government of the state of Bavaria to challenge the law in Germany's constitutional court, claiming that such radical reform requires a constitutional amendment rather than the simple legislation that passed in Parliament on June 30th by a vote of 393 to 266. Bavaria-based Cardinal Reinhard Marx, who leads the German Roman Catholic Bishops' Conference, said that he would very much welcome a legal challenge by his state.
The measure specifically states that the new law will come into force in Germany on the first day of the third month following the declaration. The delay allows a number of government agencies to revise forms and documents to eliminate references to man and woman, as required by the new law, to make the language gender neutral. So, barring any challenge to the law being accepted by the Constitutional Court, German lesbian and gay couples could be walking down the aisle by early October. Malta's parliament has also passed a marriage equality law that's scheduled to take effect at about the same time. It's now a race to see which European country becomes the 23rd on the planet and which becomes the 24th to host its first legal wedding of a lesbian or gay couple.
India's Supreme Court may review its 2013 decision that upheld the former British colony's antiquated Penal Code Section 377 that outlaws private consensual adult gay sex. But it's in a seemingly unrelated case involving the requirement that all Indian residents use a unique government-assigned 12-digit identity number, which is being challenged in the High Court as a violation of the right to privacy. The NGO LGBTQ and HIV/AIDS advocacy group NAS Foundation, which has been fighting Section 377 for years, has asked the court to overturn that law on privacy grounds. In hearings this week, one of the justices said that if privacy rights are deemed to be fundamental, then the court's 2013 Section 377 ruling fails. He and his colleagues are said to be reviewing Supreme Court rulings in 1954 and 1962, each of which concluded that privacy is not a fundamental right. Under Section 377, carnal intercourse against the order of nature with any man, woman, or animal is punishable by up to life in prison. A number of efforts in India's parliament in recent years to repeal Section 377 have failed. Its defenders say the law is not a practical problem because it's rarely enforced. Opponents say it fuels homophobia and transphobia by tacitly okaying anti-queer discrimination and abuse.
10 activists were arrested in a Tel Aviv demonstration on July 19th to protest the Israeli government's opposition to same-gender couples being able to adopt children. The government's position came in response to a question from the High Court of Justice, which is considering the issue. Thousands of people rallied against the government stance. Some held signs reading, "We are not second-class citizens." Television anchor Nadav Borenstein, who emceed the rally, said, "Me and my partner went around the entire world to try and be parents, and the country that we're citizens of is refusing to accept that our daughters are ours. We pay taxes like straight people, go to the army like straight people," he added. "So why can't we have kids like straight people?" As the Jerusalem Post noted, the government has changed its stance on the adoptions issue several times. The protest demonstration apparently prompted the government to ask the High Court for more time to again reconsider its position. There's no such thing as civil marriage in Israel. Only religious authorities can marry couples, and no traditional Jewish, Muslim, or Christian cleric will celebrate the wedding of a same-gender couple. Equality activists generally support long-running efforts in Israel to create civil marriage for both heterosexual and same-gender couples.
In this week's news of the ongoing effort in the Russian region of Chechnya to exterminate LGBTQ people, the Kremlin defended last week's inflammatory remarks of the mostly Muslim region's President Ramzan Kadyrov that called gays devils for sale and not people. Kadyrov also said during the interview on HBO to promote the Chechen sports industry that families are justified in killing LGBTQ relatives because of our faith, our mentality, customs, and traditions. Even if it's punishable under the law, he added, we would still condone it. Vladimir Putin spokesman Dmitry Peskov told reporters this week that, as for Kadyrov's interview, frankly speaking, very often his words are taken out of context and that nothing out of the ordinary was said there.
Several credible news sources have been documenting the apparent government-ordered genocide that began in Chechnya in April. Hundreds of men suspected of being gay or bisexual have been rounded up and tortured in secret gay concentration camps until they provide Chechen authorities with the names of all of their friends. The Russian LGBT network said last week that any person perceived to be lesbian or trans in Chechnya is likely to also be caught up in the pogrom. At least six deaths have been confirmed, some during torture and others in so-called honor killings by shamed fundamentalist Muslim family members.
The Trump administration has finally joined most of the Western world to condemn the purge and to urge Putin, who's the last word on what happens in the Russian Federation, to put a stop to it. French President Emmanuel Macron and German Chancellor Angela Merkel have publicly challenged Putin about the situation. Spokeswoman Heather Nauert told reporters this week that the U.S. State Department found Chechen President Kadyrov's remarks very concerning and also upsetting. She claimed that people in the administration have discussed the situation with Russian officials at the highest levels. However, there was no indication that Trump himself challenged Putin on the Chechen purge during his formal and informal talks with the Russian president at the recent G20 summit.
Several transgender people in the U.S. state of North Carolina returned to federal court this week to challenge the measure that purportedly replaced the odious HB2, which forced trans people to use the bathroom or other public facility corresponding to the gender on their birth certificate. It also banned local governments in the state from passing ordinances to protect their LGBTQ citizens from discrimination. Led by lawyers from the American Civil Liberties Union, the new filing challenges HB 142, the measure approved earlier this year and hailed by Democratic Governor Roy Cooper and Republican lawmakers as a replacement for HB 2, which cost the state millions of dollars through boycotts by sports associations, entertainers, businesses, and nonprofit groups. However, as critics noted when it was being considered, HB 142 simply puts an expiration date of 2020 on the ban of local ordinances protecting LGBTQ people and prevents the specific passage by local jurisdictions of measures to allow trans people to use the bathroom that matches their gender identity. This week's federal court filing contends that the differences between HB 142 and HB 2 are, at best, cosmetic, and that unconstitutional discrimination against LGBTQ people continues in the Tar Heel state.
We have updated numbers for last week's breaking news about the contentious Pride Parade in Seoul, South Korea. Based on initial accounts, we reported that about 10,000 marchers separated from hundreds of chanting fundamentalist Christian opponents by about 2,000 police officers did not let rainy skies dampen their enthusiasm during the July 15th parade. The Korea Herald subsequently reported the crowd to have actually topped 85,000 people, the largest ever to celebrate Pride in the South Korean capital. And it required some 6,000 police officers to successfully keep the peace. Happily, no major clashes were reported.
And finally, Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III is, at least as of July 22nd, still the Attorney General of the United States. He said he's staying on, despite President Trump's withering criticism of him during a July 18th interview with the New York Times and Washington Post revelations on July 21st about additional previously undisclosed contacts by Trump's surrogate Sessions with Russian officials during the 2016 presidential campaign. Late-night TV host Stephen Colbert has his own issues with Sessions, including the Attorney General's recent speech, behind closed doors, to the rabidly anti-queer legal firm Alliance Defending Freedom. They've represented business people who refuse to serve lesbian and gay couples because of their Christian religious beliefs. They've also helped state officials write so-called bathroom bills to prevent trans people from using public facilities that correspond to their gender identity. Colbert came up with a twist on a venerable queer rights slogan this week in the process of roasting the country's top law enforcement official and his right-wing friends.
Earlier this week, Sessions spoke to an anti-LGBT hate group in a closed-door speech. Closed door? Come on, guys, it's 2017. It's okay to come out. Let your hate flag fly. You're here, you fear, we're used to it.
That's News Wrap for the week ending July 22nd, 2017. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK, Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Michael LeBeau.
And I'm Jessica Andrea.
A straightforward explanation of privilege. Later in the program. In his Lambda Literary Award-winning debut novel, God in Pink, Hassan Namir tells the story of a young gay Iraqi confronting the war within, between his sexuality and Islam, against the backdrop of the war in his country in 2003. The author, now living in the Canadian province of British Columbia, told a similar story at this month's Denman Island Readers and Writers Festival. But this story is his own.
My name is Hassan Namir. I was born in Iraq in 1987. My whole life growing up, I knew I was different. I knew that I was gay. I think at the age of like 5 or 6, I knew I started having feelings toward people my age, like guys and stuff. I used to wear my sister's dresses growing up, play beauty pageants with them. I never liked sports, never really played any sports. I've always loved art. I loved reading and writing, I knew that when I looked at men, it was just created this like weird butterflies inside me, like growing up. So I was like, but I didn't know what it meant because it didn't really have a label. I didn't know how to put my feelings into words. And ironically enough, when I was in Amman in 2010, my dad's like sister-in-law, like my aunt, my uncle's wife, she said like that the day I was born that they knew that I was gay, but they didn't like they were just in denial, like they didn't know how like society would accept it, like they just knew and that I was different. So when we moved to Canada, we left Iraq the day of my birthday. So September 9, 1998, we left Iraq, went to Jordan, and stayed there for about a couple weeks, and then arrived in Canada September 17th, 1998. I'll never forget the date, and I'll never forget when I found out that we were moving to another country. I didn't even know what's Canada. I didn't even know what it's like. I didn't speak any word English. Like I just knew, hi, how are you? Ironically, I learned the word gay at such a young age in middle school because one of my colleagues, like school, like students, they said, oh, you're gay? I didn't know what it meant. So I remember going to like my mom and my aunt and said, what does that word even mean? And my mom right away freaked out. She's like, oh, it's a bad word. don't say that again. I don't want to hear it. So at that moment, at even such a young age, I started to associate the word gay with negativity. So for me, growing up, I just always, just kept denying myself because my parents would indirectly hint at the fact that being gay is a sign of illness. It's wrong and punishable by God. When I was 16, my dad took me to, Tim Hortons all of a sudden. He's like, I want to talk to you to confront me about something. And he said, Hassan, are you G? We didn't even say the word. The whole word. Just couldn't say it. So he started crying. What about your aunts? What about your uncles? What about your family members, your cousins, all the Iraqi community? What would they say? Because for them, it's all about what other people think. It's about the public image, the idea that people finding out, oh my God, it's scandalous, it's haram, it's forbidden, you know? So rather than him empathizing with me and putting himself in my shoes, he chose to feel sorry for me for a bit, but then he was kind of against that idea. He said, you have 2 weeks to find a job and move out because I can't accept a gay son. My sister, Rand, who I love so much, I came out to her when I was 12, and she's like, Hassan, tell me something new. She's like, I've always known and always been. We worked together at McDonald's, and I slept with the manager of McDonald's, and then she found out through another coworker, and that's when I kind of talked to her about it and all that, and it was just and it was for her. So for her, it was I'll accept you for who you are. I love you for who you are. She never once threatened me to tell my parents or anything. She's always been supportive, trying to lie for me and hide for things when I go out with a guy and So she's always been the light and support of my life. So my sister said, Hassan, you're not you don't have a job right now. You're going to school, just for once, go back in the closet again, at least until you find, get yourself with support and all that. She's like, right now, I don't think you're ready to just move out on your own and all that. Where are you going to go, I went back in the closet once again. That's when I then changed almost 360 degrees. I went through a religious phase. I thought by becoming religious that that could help me change, because I was I just don't want to lose my family. I don't want to lose them. I don't want to, what am I supposed to do, So I started going to the mosque, the Ashia Mosque, the Husseiniya, and I started reading about Islam and all that. And ironically enough, it was through that experience is when I actually finally started to accept who I am, I think, because for me, it was through that experience, by going to the mosque and realizing what it, and also on the side, I had a sexual relationship with also one of the imams as well, who's go figure, he was married, had 3 or 4 daughters and all that, but that's the thing. A lot of these men live a double life, they'll get married and their wives don't know anything. In fact, I didn't even know he was one of the imam of the mosque until after. I just met him online, and then after I started going to that mosque more often, and then I saw him there. I was like, oh, awkward. that experience, that whole going to the mosque and really opened my eyes. I read the Quran through that experience twice. And then I realized, people's interpretation is what kind of sometimes fascinates me, because the language of the Quran is very poetic, very, sometimes there's a lot of vagueness in it, a lot of open interpretations, a lot of stories. So even all the stories, the story of Lut, I've read it a few times, and that's a story that a lot of people say, they use as a source of condemning homosexuality, the idea of the people of the Lut were having sex with homosexual sex, and then God sent to destroy them. But then I read more into the story, and then I realized it was rape of angels, and that's what caused all this. So obviously there's more to it, I think. And through that experience of reading the Quran twice and becoming religious is when I actually started to accept who I am as a gay man. I think it was very interesting. Yeah, and that kind of then drew the inspiration of writing this book, So after my trip from the Middle East, I definitely hooked up with a lot of guys, and I started becoming more open about myself. And it was just a very beautiful experience. I started to accept myself. I started to like realize that, hey, this is who I am. I can change who I am. I was now I just have to accept it and become a better person through that experience. So like my whole life, you know, growing up was difficult because I was trying to confront an identity that I did not want to accept. And all that have changed when on April 9th, 2011. That day, my friend Abbas and I went to another friend's birthday, Mo. It also happened to be this guy's birthday over there. I hadn't met him in person yet, but I did add him on Facebook because I thought he was so hot. It was crazy. And he probably didn't think, he's like, who's this guy adding me, Hassan? Anyways, I told Abbas, my friend, that he said, oh, you write a card to Mo, to Tarn, and he'll write a card to Mo. I was like, well, I don't really know Tarn. Like, what am I going to say? So I just wrote a card to him, wishing him a happy birthday. And then when I gave it to him, he was wearing this, like, gray vest. I'll never forget him, this happy birthday sign right there. And he was just, like, really buffed up. And then I just gave him the card. And I was just, like, literally, like, stood like there. Would you guys believe that my heart, like, literally stopped beating the moment I saw him? I knew he was the one. I know it sounds cliche. I knew he was the one from day one. I forgot my existence, and I knew I saw my whole life through him, you know? And I just couldn't stop looking at him all night. A couple of days later, I went and told, like, one of my, school friends at SFU, I'm going to marry this guy. He's like, girl, slow it down. You just met this guy. Like, get to know him first. What if you meet him and you realize he's not the one, you know? So everything about him, like, you know, changed my life. And then he didn't want to be in a relationship at the beginning. He just got out of one, like, five-year relationship with Brian. So for him, it was just too much. And I was just coming off too strong, too. So we became friends for a couple months. And then September 9, on my birthday, he came as my official date. And then after that, after my birthday, September 9, on September 10, I just couldn't keep it longer anymore. I really, like, had strong feelings for him. So I came out to my mom. Like, I told her, I'm gay. She started, like, almost ripping her clothes, crying hysterically, you know. And then my dad told my sister, if I come home and I see him, I don't know what I'm going to do to him. So I just left the house. And I called Atar, and I was like, I don't know where I'm going to, like, live. Can I move in? Like, he lives with his mom and sister, who's now my mom. His mom took me right in. She treated me like her own son from day one. Didn't ask for rent or anything. And was just always been so amazing. So that's why I consider my mom. She's an amazing one. So, and then we lived together for like 6 months and then got engaged after he proposed. March 9th, 2012 is when we had our engagement. That's when my parents found out about the engagement. I think, we had a nice, you know, with friends and all that. And one of my friend Ricky posted photos on Facebook, and I guess he had a public profile. So my cousins found out and all that. That's when things kind of went downhill. My dad stopped talking to me. I haven't seen him for 6 years now. It's okay. And then my mom also, like, was very difficult. I finally saw my mom actually, like, a couple years ago. And now we see each other, like, here and there, but it's very, like, far in between. But we're always, like, texting each other, talking about, like, oh, like, watch, because I love watching Arabic shows. So, like, her and I would be, like, you know, gossiping and stuff together through the text and all that, even though we don't see each other that often. All my cousins stopped talking to me and everything, and it was just really bad. But I realized in the end, I'm in love with this guy, and my love is what keeps me strong. And God is so great in accepting, despite what other people say, and I know God created me this way. And he loves me just the way I am. I found this balance between religion and sexuality. I'm a very proud Muslim, and a lot of people say, oh, Islam doesn't accept it, but I think there's a lot of things that people don't see, like, that actually Islam is a very accepting and loving religion. I'm not practicing Muslim. I don't pray 5 times a day, but I do inherit all the beautiful things that my religion taught me. And one of the most important things that it taught me is to overlook this radicalism and just accept and love people for who they are, because religion is love for me.
For just one moment, people all over the world could know this love, could know this love.
Gay Iraqi-Canadian author Hassan Namir spoke at the Denman Island Readers and Writers Festival in British Columbia. His novel is called God in Pink. The next time somebody asks you why there are no pride parades for straight white men, and people still do ask, the UK pop punk band Rocking Horse Club has this melodic retort.
Life is so easy for the straight white man. A woman can't do all the things we can. Walk in the dark and feel secure. Do the same job but get paid more. What we like and we don't get shamed. We don't get raped and then get blamed. Is it so hard to understand? Life is so easy for the straight white man. Straight white man. The blacks can't do all the things we can. See the police and get left alone. No one ever tells us to go back home. And we're much less likely to go to jail. Because the system is biased against black males. The system fails unless you're pale. Life is so easy for the straight white male.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. This week, Jessica Andrea and Michael LeBeau, produced by Steve Pride, contributed program material with special thanks to Frida Worden and Wings. Mishari Rashid Alafasi, Fred Small, and the Rocking Horse Club performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentham, our contributing affiliate stations, and our listener donors for making this program possible. Look for This Way Out Radio on Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and Google+. Smile at Overnight Productions on Amazon. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Greg Gordon. We thank you for listening online at thiswayout.org and on WDIY Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, KUNM Albuquerque, New Mexico, 5GFM Kadena, South Australia, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Do stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
You are listening to Against the Grain on listener-sponsored KPFA. My name is C.S. Song. The civil rights movement fought for a better America. And with the election of Barack Obama, we were told we had arrived at that destination, a multiracial, colorblind society. But the acquittal of the killer of Trayvon Martin, the killing of Michael Brown by a white police officer, the death in police custody of Freddie Gray, and many other developments have shown that U.S. society has not in fact changed much, or at least not as much as many would have us believe. In his Oscar-nominated film, I Am Not Your Negro, Raoul Peck lyrically explores the reality of race in America today, and thus the nature of America itself, through the words of the great African-American writer James Baldwin. Baldwin, the leading literary voice of the civil rights movement, had envisioned writing a book about Malcolm X, Medgar Evers, and Dr. King, all of whom were personal friends of Baldwin's and all of whom were assassinated. But Baldwin died before completing it. Raoul Peck, through his film, gives life to that book, using his vision of it to reflect on the unfinished business of the civil rights movement and on how we ended up where we are today with continuing systemic police brutality against African Americans. The words in I Am Not Your Negro are all James Baldwin's, drawn from interviews he did and also from his writings, in which case Baldwin's words are read by the actor Samuel Jackson. Today we present excerpts from the film, and we are offering the award-winning film for your financial pledge of support to KPFA. For a pledge of $90 or more to listener-sponsored KPFA, you get the film I Am Not Your Negro on DVD. The phone number, which you can call anytime this hour, is 1-800-439-5732, easily remembered as 1-800-HEY-KPFA, 1-800-HEY-KPFA. Let's start with this portion, this audio excerpt of the film, I Am Not Your Negro.
As a member of the NAACP, Megger was investigating the murder of a black man, which had occurred months before. Had shown me letters from black people asking him to do this, and he had asked me to come with him.
Raise up, get yourself together, drive that funky soul.
I was terribly frightened. But perhaps that field trip will help us define what I mean by the word witness. I was to discover that the line which separates a witness from an actor is a very thin line indeed. Nevertheless, the line is real. I was not, for example, a black Muslim. In the same way, though for different reasons, that I never became a Black Panther. Because I did not believe that all white people were devils. And I did not want young black people to believe that. I was not a member of any Christian congregation because I knew that they had not heard and did not live by the commandment, love one another as I love you. And I was not a member of the NAACP because in the North, where I grew up, the NAACP was fatally entangled with black class distinctions, or illusions of the same, which repelled a Shushan boy like me. I did not have to deal with the criminal state of Mississippi hour by hour and day by day, to say nothing of night after night. I did not have to sweat cold sweat after decisions involving hundreds of thousands of lives. I was not responsible for raising money or deciding how to use it. I was not responsible for strategy controlling prayer meetings, marches, petitions, voting registration drives. I saw the sheriffs, the deputies, the stormtroopers more or less in passing. I was never in town to stay. This was sometimes hard on my morale, but I had had to accept as time wore on that part of my responsibility as a witness was to move as largely and as freely as possible, to write the story, and to get it out.
We should all be concerned with but one goal, the eradication of crime. The Federal Bureau of Investigation is as close to you as your nearest telephone. It seeks to be your protector in all matters within its jurisdiction. It belongs to you.
White people are astounded by Birmingham. Black people aren't. White people are endlessly demanding to be reassured that Birmingham is really on Mars. They don't want to believe, still less to act on the belief, that what is happening in Birmingham is happening all over the country. They don't want to realize that there is not one step morally or actually between Birmingham and Los Angeles. Concerns Malcolm and Martin. I watched two men coming from unimaginably different backgrounds, whose positions originally were poles apart, driven closer and closer together. By the time each died, their positions had become virtually the same position. It can be said, indeed, that Martin picked up Malcolm's burden, articulated the vision which Malcolm had begun to see, and for which he paid with his life, and that Malcolm was one of the people Martin saw on the mountaintop. Medgar was too young to have seen this happen, though he hoped for it and would not have been surprised. But Medgar was murdered first. I was older than Medgar, Malcolm, and Martin. I was raised to believe that the eldest was supposed to be a model for the younger, and was, of course, expected to die first. Not one of these three lived to be 40.
We need an organization that no one downtown loves. We need one that's ready and willing to take action. Any kind of action by any means necessary.
The very last time I saw Medgar Evers, he stopped at his house on the way to the airport so I could autograph my books for him, his wife, and children. I remember Merle Evers standing outside, smiling, and we waved. And Medgar drove to the airport and put me on the plane. Months later, I was in Puerto Rico, working on my play. Lucianne and I had spent a day or so wandering around the island, and now we were driving home. It was a wonderful, bright, and sunny day. Top of the car was down. We were laughing, talking, and the radio was playing. Then the music stopped. And a voice announced that Medgar Evers had been shot to death in the carport of his home, and his wife and children had seen the big man fall.
Evers was buried from the bullet he caught. They're mourning him down as a king. But when the shadowy sun sits on the one that fired the gun, you'll see by his grave on the stone that remains, carved next to his name, is Epitaph Green. Only a pawn in the game.
The blue sky seemed to descend like a blanket, and I couldn't say anything. I couldn't cry. I just remembered his face, a bright, blunt, handsome face, and his weariness, which he wore like his skin, and the way he said, "Road," for road. And his telling me how the tatters of clothes from a lynched body hung, flapping in the tree for days, and how he had to pass that tree every day. Medgar, gone. In America, I was free only in battle, never free to rest. And he who finds no way to rest cannot long survive the battle. And the young white revolutionary remains, in general, far more romantic than a black one. White people have managed to get through entire lifetimes in this euphoric state. But black people have not been so lucky. A black man who sees the world the way John Wayne, for example, sees it, would not be an eccentric patriot, but a raving maniac. The truth is that this country does not know what to do with this black population, dreaming of anything like the final solution.
The Negro has never been as docile as white Americans wanted to believe. That was a myth. We were not singing and dancing down the levee. We were trying to keep alive. We were trying to survive a very brutal system. The Negro has never been happy in his place.
One of the most terrible things is that, in fact, whether I like it or not, I am an American. My school really was the streets of New York City. My frame of reference was George Washington and John Wayne. But, I was a child. You know, a child opens his eyes in the world, he has to use what he sees. There's nothing else to use. And you are formed by what you see, the choices you have to make, and the way you discover
what it means to be black in New York, and then throughout the entire country. I know how you watch as you grow older, and this is not a figure of speech. The corpses of your brothers and your sisters pile up around you, and not for anything they have done. They were too young to have done anything. But what one does realize is that when you try to stand up and look the world in the face like you had a right to be here, you have attacked the entire power structure of the Western world. Forget the Negro problem. Don't write any voting acts. We had that. It's called the 15th Amendment. During the Civil Rights Bill of 1964, what you had to look at is what is happening in this country. And what is really happening is a brother has murdered brother knowing it was his brother. White men have lynched Negroes knowing them to be their sons. White women have had Negroes burned knowing them to be their lovers. It is not a racial problem. It's a problem whether or not you're willing to look at your life and be responsible for it and then begin to change it. That great Western house I come from is one house, and I am one of the children of that house. Simply, I'm the most despised child of that house. And it is because the American people are unable to face the fact that in fact I am flesh of their flesh, bone of their bone, created by them. My blood, my father's blood is in that soil.
I've always been struck in America by an emotional poverty so bottomless and a terror of human life, of human touch, so deep that virtually no American appears able to achieve any viable organic connection between his public stance and his private life. This failure of the private life has always had the most devastating effect on American public conduct and on black-white relations. If Americans were not so terrified of their private selves, they would never have become so dependent on what they called the Negro problem.
But they said it wasn't nice to say nigger.
This problem, which they invented in order to safeguard their purity, has made of them criminals and monsters, and it is destroying them. And this, not from anything blacks may or may not be doing, but because of the role of a guilty and constricted white imagination as assigned to the blacks.
An excerpt from the Oscar-nominated documentary film I Am Not Your Negro about James Baldwin and his words that still, you might agree, apply today. Directed by Raoul Peck is this film. And I'm CS. You are listening to Against the Grain on this, the second day of KPFA Summer Fun Drive. We're going to go back to more audio from this film that has garnered many accolades and awards and many just superlative reviews from critics. I just want to let people know what we have on offer today. We have on offer as thank you gifts for your pledge of support to a corporate-free KPFA, the film I Am Not Your Negro on DVD. And that's a $90 pledge to KPFA. $90 or more gets you as a thank you gift this film, I Am Not Your Negro, 1-800-439-5732. You can call that anytime this hour, 1-800-439-5732. Easily remembered as 1-800-HEY-KPFA. By the way, you can divide that into six equal monthly installments, if you like. So that would come out to only $15 a month over 6 months, and you get this film, and you don't have to pay all your installments before this film comes your way. Call the phone room and get the information, 1-800-439-5732. But that's not all. We are also offering a Baldwin combo pack, which consists of the film I Am Not Your Negro on DVD and a wonderful 14-plus-hour audio compilation put together by the Pacifica Radio Archives, which contains every James Baldwin recording held in the archives. And the archives, as you may know, covers the five Pacifica radio stations that include KPFA in Berkeley. More than 14 hours of James Baldwin on two MP3 CDs. There are interviews, panel discussions, speeches that James Baldwin gave, historic speeches that James Baldwin gave at various locations, including in the Bay Area. 14-plus hours of James Baldwin on this Pacifica Radio and James Baldwin, the complete collection audio compilation. And the combo pack then gets you the this audio compilation, Pacifica Radio and James Baldwin, and the film I Am Not Your Negro. And that comes to a $250 pledge to KPFA, which, if you broke it down to six monthly installments, comes out to $41 and change per month. So the Baldwin combo for a pledge of $250, the film I Am Not Your Negro for a $90 pledge to KPFA, or $15 per month over a period of 6 months, $15 per month over 6 months. 1-800-439-5732 is the phone number, 1-800-439-KPFA, or 1-800-HEY-KPFA. You can also donate online at kpfa.org. You can go to kpfa.org on your computer, on your iPad, or your mobile phone. Let's return now to more audio portions of this award-winning film, I Am Not Your Negro.
All over the country, families such as this are enjoying new prosperity. They have new interests, new standards of living, a buying power they've never enjoyed before. They're good prospects for practically all types of goods and services. All too often, though, they're overlooked prospects. Since 1940, in San Francisco alone, the Negro market has increased by 89%. Here are millions of customers for what you have to sell. Customers with $15 billion to spend.
Someone once said to me that the people in general cannot bear very much reality. He meant by this that they prefer fantasy to a truthful recreation of their experience. People have quite enough reality to bear by simply getting through their lives, raising their children, dealing with the eternal conundrums of birth, taxes, and death.
Let me put it this way, that from a very literal point of view, the harbors and the ports and the railroads of the country, the economy, especially of the southern states, could not conceivably be what it has become if they had not had, and do not still have indeed, and for so long, for many generations, cheap labor. It is a terrible thing for an entire people to surrender to the notion that 1/9 of its population is beneath them. And until that moment, until the moment comes when we, the American people, are able to accept the fact that I have to accept, for example, that my ancestors are both white and black, that on that continent we are trying to forge a new identity for which we need each other, and that I am not a ward of America, I'm not an object of missionary charity. I'm one of the people who built the country. Until this moment, there is scarcely any hope for the American dream, because the people who are denied participation in it, by their very presence, will wreck it. And if that happens, it's a very grave moment for the West. Thank you.
studio today with seven men who have two things in common. They are entertainers and artists, and they've all come to Washington. They're seven out of some 200,000 American citizens who came to the Capitol to march for freedom and for jobs. Will this tremendous outburst now lead to a course of action, Mr. Belafonte?
The now that is being spoken about is the fact that in 100 years, finally, through whatever the causes have been in history, and most of them have been because of oppression, the Negro people have strongly and fully taken the bit in their teeth. They're asking absolutely no quarter from anyone. But I do say that the bulk of the interpretation of whether this thing is going to end successfully and joyously or is going to end disastrously lays very heavily with the white community. It lays very heavily with the profiteers. It lays very heavily with the vested interests. It lays very heavily with a great middle stream in this country of people who have refused to commit themselves or even have the slightest knowledge that these things have been going on.
I am speaking as a member of a certain democracy in a very complex country, which insists on being very narrow-minded. Simplicity is taken to be a great American virtue, along with sincerity.
I'm sorry.
I am deeply sorry.
And I'm sorry.
I'm deeply sorry about
that. And there are no excuses.
I am sorry.
You've made plenty of mistakes.
For that, I apologize.
I am very sorry.
You know, I'm sorry I did this to you, but you got to get used to it. It's one of those little problems in life.
I take full responsibility.
I'm here today to again apologize.
I'm just apologizing for that to her.
For any mistakes I've made, I take full responsibility. It's an honor to serve the city of Ferguson and the people who live there.
One of the results of this is that immaturity is taken to be a virtue too. So that someone like that, let's say, John Wayne, who spent most of his time on screen admonishing Indians, was in no necessity to grow up. I had been in London on this particular night. We were free, and we decided to treat ourselves to a really fancy, friendly dinner. The head waiter came and said there was a phone call for me, and my sister Gloria rose to take it. She was very strange when she came back. She didn't say anything, and I began to be afraid to ask her anything. Then, nibbling at something she obviously wasn't tasting, she said, "Well, I've got to tell you because the press is on its way over here. They have just killed Malcolm."
There is nothing in the evidence offered by the Book of the American Republic which allows me really to argue with the cat who says to me, "They needed us to pick the cotton, and now they don't need us anymore. And now they don't need us, they're going to kill us all off, just like they did the Indians." And I can't say it's a Christian nation. They were, your brothers will never do that to you, because the record is too long and too bloody. That's all we have done. All your buried corpses now begin to speak.
Audio portions of a film, a searing film, an amazing film, a beautifully rendered film, a beautifully produced film called I Am Not Your Negro. And this is Against the Grain. And I'm CS, and this is on listener-sponsored KPFA, which brings you voices, literally voices like these, including, of course, James Baldwin, who is the mover and shaker. His words are the mover and shaker behind this beautiful award-winning film, I Am Not Your Negro. We'll go back to more of that film in audio form. And I want to let you know again that we are offering this film, which will make an impression. It'll make a deep impression on you and whoever you give it to, whoever you share it with, whatever library you offer it to after you're done with it. This film, I Am Not Your Negro, is yours as a thank you gift for a pledge of support to KPFA. The phone number is 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-HEY-KPFA, 1-800-439-KPFA. You can also donate online at kpfa.org. $90 pledge or more to KPFA. You give to KPFA, and what do you get? Well, you get KPFA, and you get the knowledge and understanding that you are helping support this radio station that brings you these kinds of voices, but you also get a fabulous thank you gift in the form of an amazing film called I Am Not Your Negro, which has won many accolades and awards, including nominated for an Oscar for Best Feature Documentary in 2017, this year, Best Documentary from the Los Angeles Film Critics Association, 4 Film Festival Audience Awards, Toronto, Philadelphia, the Hamptons, and Chicago, 2 IDA Documentary Awards nominations, including Best Feature, 5 Cinema Eye Honors Award nominations, including Outstanding Achievement in Nonfiction Feature Filmmaking and Direction, Best Documentary Nomination, Film Independent Spirit Awards, Best Documentary Nomination, Gotham Awards. I could go on and on. I mean, there's no, you know, if you're wondering whether this film is good enough for you, this film is produced well enough for you, is put together well enough, is compelling enough for you, is of the quality that you expect really, really good films and documentary films to have, to possess, then let me put your mind at ease here, because this film has won so many awards and gotten so many superlative reviews from critics that it will satisfy you. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-HEY-KPFA. Again, kpfa.org on your computer, your iPad, your mobile phone. You can do it, and we need you to do it, and you get something thrilling and amazing. Thrilling, by the way, is what one critic called I Am Not Your Negro, available for a $90 pledge to KPFA. A portrait of one man's confrontation with a country that, murder by murder, as he once put it, quote, devastated my universe. One of the best movies you are likely to see this year. That was a critic writing in the New York Times. A critic in The Guardian wrote, a striking work of storytelling, one of the best movies about the civil rights era ever made. One of the best movies about the civil rights era ever made. This might be the only movie about race relations that adequately explains, with sympathy, the root causes. Vividly intelligent, says another critic about I Am Not Your Negro. James Baldwin was the prose poet of our injustice and humanity. His voice speaks even more powerfully today than it did 50 years ago. The times have caught up with his scalding eloquence. Another critic lauding this film, I Am Not Your Negro, a $90 pledge to KPFA, $15 per month over 6 months. You may not even miss that from your bank account. And maybe if you would, if you will, then don't pledge that amount of money. But maybe $15, which is what? About, I don't know. I don't drink the coffee, the artisanal beverages. But what is that? A couple of cups of something special every month. Or maybe it's only one cup of something special every month. In any case, 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732. As I mentioned, you can also get the Baldwin combo pack that we are offering today, which is the film I Am Not Your Negro on DVD, plus a 2 MP3 CD set of Baldwin audio. It's called Pacifica Radio and James Baldwin, the complete collection. And it has 14 hours, more than 14 hours of James Baldwin talking and presenting and being interviewed and being part of a panel discussion over the years. It's a historic audio put together by the Pacifica Radio Archives. It's got speeches talking about a race, about the state of the U.S., about where we are as a nation, about great leaders, about dissent, about the civil rights movement, about threats to the soul of this nation. There is so much in this Pacifica Radio James Baldwin collection, and you can get that and the film for a $250 pledge to KPFA, kpfa.org, or 1-800-439-5732. This film is not about surface issues, about superficial matters, about trivial pursuits. This film, in my humble opinion, goes to the heart of what ails this nation today. This film is about the soul of this nation, what lies at the core of so many problems and dilemmas and injustices facing us today. So if you want to get something that will make you think and rethink the situation of this nation in this current historical moment, guided by somebody who wrote, in some cases 50 years ago, his words are so prescient, his words are so relevant, and you will learn so much from James Baldwin. He wasn't just a social commentary or an uncompromising social critic. He certainly was, but he was a fantastic writer. He used and he put together words in a way, a brilliant and compelling way that few have matched. And those words are the foundation, the linchpin of this film, I Am Not Your Negro. So if you don't read Baldwin or you haven't read much of Baldwin, hear his words, absorb his words, understand and grasp his message, his many messages in this film, I Am Not Your Negro, a $90 or more pledge to KPFA. It's an easy phone call. It's a quick phone call. You're going to feel great because you're going to be giving to something that you really care about and you depend upon, perhaps. Maybe I'm assuming things, but maybe you really do depend on KPFA. And you are going to be getting something in return. Obviously, that great feeling. Obviously, listening in tomorrow and understanding that it's because of you, it's partly because of you coming together in solidarity with others that you are hearing material, interesting, compelling, provocative, relevant, non-mainstream, non-corporate information coming from your radio station. You'll get that feeling, plus you'll get this film, I Am Not Your Negro, on DVD. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-KPFA. 1-800-HEY-KPFA. I'm haying out to you. I'd like you to hey back to me. Hey, KPFA. Give us a call. 1-800-HEY-KPFA. Give whatever you can. We have all kinds of thank you gifts here at any of a number of different pledge levels. If $90 doesn't suit you, then ask for what's available for $60. If $250 suits you, consider the Baldwin combo pack that we have on offer today. Okay, now let's return to yet another edited excerpt, an audio portion from the film, I Am Not Your Negro.
But I say violence is necessary. Violence is a part of America's culture. It is as American as cherry pie.
Black power, brothers.
If we were white, if we were Irish, if we were Jewish, if we were Poles, if we had, in fact, in your mind, a frame of reference, our heroes would be your heroes, too. Nat Turner would be a hero for you instead of a threat. Malcolm X might still be alive. And, everyone is very proud of brave little Israel, a state against which I have nothing. No, I don't want to be misinterpreted. I'm not an anti-Semite. But, when the Israelis pick up guns, or the Poles, or the Irish, or any white man in the world says, give me liberty or give me death, the entire white world applauds. when a black man says exactly the same thing, word for word, he is judged a criminal and treated like one, and everything possible is done to make an example of this bad nigger so there won't be any more like him.
Look out across this land we love. Look about you, wherever you are. There's unending scenic beauty. And there's freedom. It's an inherent American right, meaning many different things to every single citizen.
We've dropped too many bombs on Vietnam now.
Let us save our national honor. Stop the bombing and stop the war.
What I'm trying to say to this country, to us, is that we must know this. We must realize this. That no other country in the world have been so fat and so sleek and so safe and so happy and so irresponsible and so dead. No other country can afford to dream of a Plymouth and a wife and a house with a fence and the children growing up safely to go to college and to become executives and then to marry and have the Plymouth and the house and so forth. A great many people do not live this way and cannot imagine it and do not know that when we talk about democracy, this is what we mean. All of the Western nations have been caught in a lie, the lie of their pretended humanism. This means that their history has no moral justification and that the West has no moral authority. Vile as I am, states one of the characters in Dostoevsky's The Idiot, I don't believe in the wagons that bring bread to humanity. For the wagons that bring bread to humanity may coldly exclude a considerable part of humanity from enjoying what is brought. For a very long time, America prospered. This prosperity cost millions of people their lives. Now, not even the people who are the most spectacular recipients of the benefits of this prosperity are able to endure these benefits. They can neither understand them nor do without them. Above all, they cannot imagine the price paid by their victims or subjects for this way of life. And so they cannot afford to know why the victims are revolting. This is the formula for a nation or kingdom decline. For no kingdom can maintain itself by force alone. Force does not work the way its advocates think. In fact, it does. It does not, for example, reveal to the victim the strength of the adversary.
Excerpts from the film, audio excerpts from the film I Am Not Your Negro by Raoul Peck, about James Baldwin, but really about where we are today and what James Baldwin said so many years ago that resonates so clearly today, shedding light on the enduring problem. And that's a polite word, at the center of U.S. society. And I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain. And these are the kinds of voices that Pacifica Radio and KPFA have embraced and supported and delivered to listeners over many, many decades. And so I'm asking you to keep that going and to get a film that will stir your heart, as it did mine, and that will help you understand. Help you understand. Pacifica Radio helps you understand, I believe. KPFA, I bet, helps you understand. The film is I Am Not Your Negro on DVD, $15 per month over 6 months. Just talk to the phone room, 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-HEY-KPFA. 1-800-HEY-KPFA. 1-800-439-5732. $90 pledge or more gets you the film, I Am Not Your Negro. And by the way, if the audio makes you think, oh, I'm getting it, no. There is so much remarkable footage in this film. The images, the faces, the powerful footage from the civil rights area, from Ferguson, from places where people like Tamir Rice have encountered directly the violence of the state and of the police. The film, the evocative images that give tremendous emotional weight to Baldwin's words are here. It's the film, 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-HEY-KPFA. And if you need an incentive, I have an incentive. Well, there are a lot of incentives, of course. One is this thank you gift. But if you call 1-800-439-5732 in the next 10 minutes and all of your pledges amount to $650 total. It's a collective thing. That's what KPFA is. It's a collective thing. Then Jerry in Richmond and Lydia in Paradise Park. Wow, Paradise Park. Lydia in Paradise Park and Jerry in Richmond. These are two KPFA listeners and staunch supporters. They will match your pledge dollar for dollar. If you want the film, I Am Not Your Negro, on DVD for a $90 pledge, they will make it a $180 pledge to KPFA. Your dollars are doubled. Your dollars go twice as far because of Jerry and Lydia. And if I can't get a bunch of you to go to your phone and pledge $650 collectively, because it's always a collective thing with KPFA, it's about collectivity. It's not about people acting alone or being atomized and alienated in this world that can be often overwhelming. But if I can't get you to do that collectively, then this money doesn't come our way. So a lot is on the line right now. We've got less than 10 minutes. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-HEY-KPFA. Maybe your membership has lapsed. Maybe it's been a few years since you subscribe. Maybe you've never subscribed and you've gotten like 10 years of KPFA free, which you're entitled to, I guess. We're not coming out there reaching our arm through the radio and grabbing you and forcing you to do anything. And that's actually what I love about a listener-sponsored radio and media. But you've been listening for 10 years. You pledge now for $90, and that's like $9 a year for the last 10 years. And that might be much more than KPFA has been worth to, much less than what KPFA has been worth to you over the last 10 years. What a bargain, $9 a year for KPFA over 10 years. Think about giving, thinking about making that step and feeling great about doing it. 1-800-HEY-KPFA, 1-800-439-5732. So this guy, James Baldwin, remarkable person. His many books include Go Tell It on the Mountain, Notes of a Native Son, and The Fire Next Time. He was born in Harlem. He spent many years in France, where he moved to escape the racism and homophobia of the U.S., and his work explores the intricacies of racial, sexual, and class distinctions. He was a trailblazer. He was an openly gay man who wrote about queer themes, so he wasn't just a lacerating critic of racism. And he was spied on, predictably, by the FBI. The FBI gathered a massive folder on James Baldwin's writings, political views, and activities, including his sexuality. 1-800-439-5732. Baldwin's FBI file contains, this is a good trivia question, contains how many pages of documents? 1,884 pages of documents collected from 1960 until the early 1970s. You can compare that to 110 pages collected by the FBI on Truman Capote and 9 pages on Henry Miller. James Baldwin's FBI file contains 1,884 pages of documents. And, you know, I believe that with the rise of white supremacy and white supremacist groups and reactionary figures and media, that this and racist violence, that James Baldwin's words are so relevant and so important today. And you might agree that there are very few mass media outlets, including radio stations, that are squarely on the left. You know, some of them are kind, you know, they're kind of moderate, some, you know, kind of liberal, moderate, centrist. Not to equate liberal with centrist, by the way, but, you know, kind of moderate. And of course, there are a ton of right wing outlets. If you believe that KPFA has its place and needs to have its place on the radio dial, on your computer, kpfa.org, if you believe this bulwark of critical information against the tide of the right is important, get this information and get this film. It will amaze and astound you. It's beautifully put together. Raoul Peck, the director, the filmmaker, has done a tremendous job, and he really dived into the archives of the Baldwin estate. He was given permission to go in there, unprecedented access, by the way, to Baldwin's estate while making the film, partly because Baldwin's sister admired Peck's film about the Congolese leftist leader Patrice Lumumba, who was overthrown by the CIA. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. We are still working on this match. Get put up by Jerry in Richmond and Lydia in Paradise Park. I want to thank some people, and I want you to call while I'm thanking these people. A lot of people have pledged for the film, but we have not gotten there because we're really working only in $90 increments. And again, you can pledge $15 a month over 6 months, and you can get this film much sooner than 6 months, by the way. Jerry in Richmond, Lydia in Paradise Park, Mark Lampkin in Vallejo, he just pledged. Donald McPherson in Berkeley, he just pledged. Jeffrey Dykman or Dickman in Richmond, that's a familiar name. Thank you for pledging again, Jeffrey. Deborah Lieb or Leib in San Francisco just pledged. Sharon Broadhead in Menlo Park just pledged. Lydia Blanchard pledged this hour. Grace Hirsch in San Francisco pledged this hour. Lynn Rundell in Paradise Park. Two Paradise Parks that I've mentioned. She pledged this hour. Thank you so much to Mark and Donald and Jeffrey and Deborah and Sharon and Lydia and Grace and Lynn. And there are so many other people out there who I believe would really benefit from this film, this award-winning film, this film about a man who KPFA has been there for, and Pacifica Radio has been there for. We've been there for people like Rosa Parks and Paul Ropes and countless other dissidents and freedom fighters. Today we're here for the activists of Black Lives Matter and of Occupy and of those struggling against Trump. But, you know, we have never been an institution that one can take for granted. This is a contingent world, and this survival of the station, the very existence of the station is contingent. It's contingent on listener support. We don't get money from corporations. You don't hear, there's some radio stations, they call themselves public, but you hear the underwriting credits and you hear the corporations and the big foundations that give money to them. You hear about the mattress companies or the oil companies. You don't hear that on KPFA. So we're at a disadvantage. We're kind of the underdog, even vis-a-vis the, quote, public radio universe. So if you like the underdog, and sorry, but I've always been a big underdog supporter, and I believe in the underdog. And in this case, I really, really believe in the underdog. And if you believe in KPFA and the underdog, and you want a film about a man And there's so much more in this. You know, I think you heard the voices of Malcolm X in there and Dr. King and some of the audio portions that we played. But there's just so much in here. This man was an underdog. He spoke truth to power. I am not your Negro. A $90 or greater pledge gets you this film. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. One more incentive. You know, we have to kind of pull our weight around here, does Against the Grain and every other program. Yesterday, you know, we didn't do very well at all. We got very few calls. And so I'm feeling like we want to really have a strong showing today. We want to make sure the people around here know that we have a lot of support from people, whether they're in the Bay Area or Northern California or Central California or anywhere around the world, because a lot of people I know rely on us via kpfa.org or againstthegrain.org. So get your dollars doubled, but also make a statement to the people here that Against the Grain is something that you really care about and maybe you depend on and that you want to survive and that you want to maybe even thrive, even though nobody's getting rich around here. I can personally guarantee that. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. It's not too late to call. I've been told we're $120 away from making this match of $650. That means two of you go into your phones right now. Right now, no time like the present, no time like exactly right now. You will help us go make that match, and it'll be worth, your two calls will be worth $650 because you'll take us over the top.